Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff this week on the show. Mainly going to be a TV week.
Yeah.
We have our two normal TV reviews to do, which is Doctor Who and Twin Peaks. But these were two abnormal episodes of television.
Yes, two really fantastic, very stuffed episodes of television with a lot to talk about. So I think it will serve to be sufficient as the main topic this week.
Yeah, I think we're going to devote more time to both of these than maybe we normally even do.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Like, remember 2 weeks ago when Doctor Who was Empress of Mars and we didn't have anything to say?
Yeah.
That's not the case anymore.
Definitely not the case this week.
Yeah, so thumbs up to both of those and eyebrows raised.
Yeah.
How about that? And then we're going to talk about a little bit of news and some other things. First off, I want to do a quick piece of housekeeping.
Yeah.
Which is that I am doing something kind of cool for the podcast, which is, this is a really long story, but longtime subscribers might have noticed that for a long time, the way our podcast feed has worked is that it's always had the most recent, like, batch of episodes in it. So this is the RSS feed, subscribe through iTunes or any other podcast app. That's what you get, is like the most recent batch of episodes. That's because an old hosting service we used would only feed 24 episodes at a time into the feed. And we obviously have many more than 24 episodes.
Yes.
So finally last year, and I know I'm like 6 months late on this, but late last year I finally, we ponied up for a nicer podcast hosting service, and it's wonderful and I'm very much enjoying it, but I finally kind of got the technical details on how to do this, and I am updating our feed so it will have every single episode of the show. The feed had gone back to episode 134 as of late, because this podcast hosting service kept everything that I put in there. It just didn't have older stuff.
Yeah.
So finally, and this was a long process because I had to go through my files and find the title of every podcast, the date of every podcast. I had all the files, but getting all the stuff of like actually making them presentable as a piece of, you know, metadata. And
yeah, instead like of just like this dump of like a like 3 hour long audio file that the title's like A3BCCCX2.
Exactly. So I had to get all that together, and then today I spent a lot of my day working on this and got the first 75 episodes into the feed, and it should not be spamming your feed, at least with the apps I've tested it on. They're all backdated to the original date they were released on. So, you know, our first episode was in June of 2012, so it's dated June of 2012.
And then God, that was such a long time ago.
Really a long time ago. And so that's where that is. And so it just, if you want to get those episodes in your normal feed and not have to go seek them out on the website or something, they are all there. Soon they're going to be all 1 through now 195 on to 200, which is barreling on down towards us. And so everything will be in there. And like I said, I did 75 today and stopped there because 75 is actually, those are the original episodes that were WGTC Radio for those.
Oh yeah, the Halcyon days.
The longtime listeners.
Yeah.
Remember that. So as 1 through 75, and then I'll get working and probably, you know, 76 through 133 will get up there. But yeah, should not spam your feed in terms of like they won't appear as new episodes and auto-download. Again, I can't speak to how every podcast app on the planet behaves.
Yeah.
But I also think, like, even if some people will use an app and it's worst-case scenario, it's worth getting them all in the feed just for posterity's sake.
Yeah.
So the entire Weekly Stuff podcast is there. And if you want to hear our thoughts on when the Xbox One announced they were no longer doing their DRM policies, we have a whole episode on that.
Oh, yeah.
Man, or if you want to hear episode 69.5, which is the one where we were recording episode 70, and that was the one about the video game consoles, and it erased itself.
Right.
And we lost an episode, and so then we did episode 69.5, which is a 20-minute episode of us feeling sorry for ourselves.
It's funny, like, because it was actually just the other day I was thinking about something, and then like the thought occurred to me, it's like, didn't we, like, remember back when we had, like, some podcasts that got deleted? Because there was, like, a year or so there where we had, like, some severe technical issues that we had to iron out. Mm-hmm. And, like, yeah, there were a couple of podcasts that were basically lost to time. And luckily that has not happened in, like, 5 years now, so.
Yeah, and, you know, I could very easily not put 69.5 into the feed, but I'm like, it's there. I'm going to do it.
It's an important part of the history of the show.
It's a numbered episode of the podcast. So yes, that's a project for posterity's sake. I've got other projects in the work. I think as we are heading towards episode 200, which, yes, we do have plans for, you know, I think just trying to make sure everything is shipshape with the podcast.
Yeah. We've been doing this for a long time now.
Yes.
It's important to, like, At a certain point, you have to take into consideration the fact that we've been doing this for over 5 years.
Yes. Yeah. The episodes I uploaded today were from across three separate calendar years.
Yeah.
Which is nuts. So, anyway, Sean, what have you been up to? Anything to talk about?
Not a whole lot of stuff to talk about. I've just kind of been putzing around, trying out some stuff. I've been going back and rewatching some more classic Doctor Who. It's been a while since I kind of dove into that much. So I rewatched Survival, because the woman who wrote that is also wrote the episode from last week, I guess. Yeah. And Survival's awesome. That's a great, brilliant Seventh Doctor story. And I've also been, like, rewatching some Third Doctor stuff, and that's just been kind of fun. Rewatching some Roger Delgado Master. Nice. I think I might rewatch the full... I think it's season 8 is the one where he's introduced, and he's basically the villain of every episode or every story of that season.
I gotta see that.
Yeah, I think I might just do a full rewatch of that one, because nice. That would be fun to do. But that's mostly what I've been up to. Nothing big so far.
Yeah, I've been kind of laying low, too. Been working on these projects. I finished Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess. Really liked that game. That game gets stronger as it goes along, and there's a stretch... Like, the four central middle dungeons in the game where you're getting the Mirror of Twilight together.
Right.
And they're the Arbiter's Grounds, the Snowpeak Ruins, the Temple of Time, and the City in the Sky. That is a, like, perfect stretch of game. Those four dungeons are four out-of-the-park home run dungeons, and just everything around there, there's very little fat on the game at that point because it got all the exposition out of the way right. in the first 40 hours or whatever. And just that stretch is wonderful, and then I think the home stretch of the game is very strong as well. So I really enjoyed finishing that. And then I thought about moving on to Skyward Sword just because I'm like, I'm in the zone. I should just... That's the last 3D Zelda I haven't played. And I put it in, and that game looks so horrible on Wii, upscaled to 1080p. Like,
because an important thing to note about you playing Twilight Princess, in case people don't remember, is you've been playing the remakes of all of those games. So you've been playing the nice, prettied up versions, even like Ocarina and Majora's Mask and Wind Waker.
But there's something wrong with Skyward Sword. Like, there must have been something in the way, like, they coded that game. And there are just things that the Wii never does well, like anti-aliasing it has a problem with. But when you put in Mario Galaxy, which I've also been playing, that's a beautiful game that holds up. You see the jagged lines and stuff, but it doesn't really bother you. Skyward Sword, like, the text is almost too blurry to read. The faces look wrong, like Link has a problem. Like, he got really bad bee sting or something, and half of his face is, like, dead. I don't know. And just, like, the whole thing is just, like, it's more macro blocking and jagginess than it is game. And I even, like, I was like, did Twilight Princess look like this? And I put it in, like, okay, Twilight Princess on Wii is not a great-looking game.
No.
It looks better than that. Like, it's amazing. I put that in and played, like, 10 minutes of it just to check. And it was because my brother has saves across the whole, you know, and I could just go to any point in the game. But, like, I don't know. Like, I had to just take a step back. Maybe I can get back to it and not be a snob about the graphics. Because usually I'm totally okay looking past that. It was just that plus the first hour of Skyward Sword... That game assumes you have never interfaced with a game before in any way.
Okay.
Like, it doesn't just do, hey, press Z and look up here to talk to me. It's like, here's how you walk. Here's how you move.
I do love when video games do, like, bother with the control stick thing, as if, like, even if you're someone who's literally never played a video game before, the very first thing you're going to do when you hold that controller is, whether on purpose or by complete accident, push that control stick and see that the character moved.
Yeah, so I just needed to take a break, and maybe I can get back to it. It is, like, Zelda definitely, over its 3D era, has had this tutorial drift.
Yeah.
Where Ocarina of Time... You know, you might look back on that and say that game has some heavy tutorialization, but it was the first game of its kind.
Yeah, and it's like, if you've played a video game before in your life, you can get through the tutorial of Ocarina, as someone who very recently played through Ocarina, in about 7 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
So
no,
it's like, it's a bit tedious in terms of how hand-holdy it is, but you get through it quickly if you know how to do it.
Exactly, and also, that game has an excuse for being hand-holdy. Games didn't have cameras for very long by the time Ocarina of Time was out. You know, things like that. And then Majora's Mask is, you know, it actually does nothing because it's just Ocarina of Time control, so they assume you know how to play it.
Yeah.
And then Wind Waker has a good amount. Twilight Princess has too much. Yeah. And then Skyward Sword is like, you're an idiot. Fuck you. You're going to read how to move your character or something.
Okay.
And it's like, you can just tell with Breath of the Wild, like, that was one of the main things they wanted to fix because they went all the way back of, like, no tutorializing. That was a serious issue. So anyway, and my brother told me that really never stops happening in that game.
Yeah,
so.
I've never played through Skyward Sword, but that is definitely the smoke on the street or whatever with that game is that, yeah.
So I'll play it someday. What I've been playing instead while I have my Wii out is Mario Galaxy games.
Cool.
Because I'm so excited for Mario Odyssey. This is how I'm getting my fix. And I had been kind of playing through a playthrough of Mario Galaxy 1 off and on for like the last year, and then I gave you my Wii U for a while, so right, I didn't have it. And then when you gave it back to me, I started playing it again, and I was just trying to, the goal of like getting all 120 stars in the game, at which point you unlock Super Luigi Galaxy, which is the same game, but now you can play as Luigi.
Well, that's not much of a reward, is it?
It's not as good of a reward as Mario Galaxy 2. But, yeah, so I finally, like, 100%ed that game. Well, not as Luigi, but as Mario. So I was happy because I've never done that, and that game is 10 years old this year. So,
right.
Love that game. So I, like, over the last year, I've played a fresh save of that whole game. And then I'm like, Mario Galaxy 2 is even better, and I have not played it since 2010. So I've busted that out, and I already have 70-some stars in it.
Jesus.
Because that is such an amazing game. You guys know what I think about Mario Galaxy 2. I forgot just how much I love it, though. Like, it really would be kind of a fight if I had to pick what is my favorite Mario game. Like, in my heart and nostalgia and all that, it's always going to be Mario 64 for a number of reasons. But, like, if I'm saying, what do I really think is, like, pound for pound the best Mario, I might say Mario Galaxy 2, because that game is so fucking good. And I've been in, as you can tell, in like 5 days I've gotten 70 some stars.
Yeah.
And that game has 240 to get.
So, good God.
Yeah.
That is a lot.
You get 120 and then you unlock another 120. So, and I've never gotten that far.
What do you get when you do 240 stars in that game?
I don't know. Because actually,
you get to play as three Luigis or something?
You get something actually, because I know there's in total 242. And so there's two extra ones. But I've never gotten to the end of it. So yeah, because I was not as completionist with games when that originally came out, which was 7 years ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway. So I've been having fun with that, and at some point I'm going to play Horizon Zero Dawn. It's sitting there on my PS4, but I've been having fun with Mario, so why not? Mario takes a little, at this point in my life, probably takes less like paying attention than a shiny new Horizon Zero Dawn.
But thinking about you saying that it was recently the 10th anniversary of Super Mario Galaxy or whatever. Also, I believe it was yesterday, it might have been 2 days ago, was the 20th anniversary of Digimon. And
nice.
That was just kind of cool to see and be like, oh yeah, we're old people at this one. It's like, fuck, Digimon is 20 years old. Like, I remember
this week was
like watching that cartoon, like the first episode of the cartoon when I was a kid.
You know what has made me feel older than literally I think anything else in my life, including up to and including the birth of my niece and nephew, is Harry Potter turned 20 this week.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, the publication of the first book. Now, that was only in the UK. None of us got it then.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that made me want to cry a little bit.
Yeah, it's weird to sort of just, like, take stock of the passage of time every now and again and be like, oh, right, Digimon has been around for 2 decades because I've been around for over 2 decades at this point.
Yep.
So, of course, Digimon is that old. But I just feel like Digimon has always been a cartoon from, like, 5 years ago or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird.
All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to some news. There's some weird stuff to talk about this week.
Yeah, some follow-up news.
Let's start up again with the firing of Chris Lord and Phil Miller, or some combination of names there, from Phil Lord and Chris Miller, I think, from the Han Solo Star Wars
Lord Miller movie. And Phil Chris.
Exactly. So we talked about this, like, literally as the news was breaking last week on the show, and by the time the show had come out, you know, more rumors were out there and stuff. But now we have concrete details. So just to tell you, like, the absolute facts, obviously Phil Lord and Chris Miller were fired. That's been pretty well confirmed. They did not just quit. They were fired. We can talk about the reasons why in a minute. But they have replaced them with, of all people, Ron Howard.
Yeah.
Opie himself.
Yes.
Director of some truly great and truly terrible films. But we can talk
about
that.
Did you know they made 3 of the Da Vinci Code movies?
Yeah.
Like, that one, the most recent one came out last year, and I had no fucking idea.
No one saw it.
Yeah.
But it did come out.
It's like, I was impressed that I knew they had made 2 of them, and then I saw when I was looking at Ron Howard's filmography after this news came out, I'm like, wait, what the fuck?
That is the closest he's gotten to Star Wars, because that movie co-starred Felicity Jones, who played Jyn Erso. Erso, whatever her name was, in Rogue One.
Maybe they're building the Star Wars Ron Howard shared cinematic universe now.
Could Tom Hanks be in it with his terrible Da Vinci Code haircut?
Yes.
Anyway, so Ron Howard will be coming in to finish the shoot, and then I guess they're just going to keep shooting through the summer doing reshoots. And, yeah, I mean, there's so much that is going to be left to be decided, such as who's going to get director's credit. If you don't know how that works, the Directors Guild of America, what they say goes, basically they get to review the situation. Everyone would expect that if more than 50% of the footage in the movie was filmed by Lord and Miller, they will get sole credit. And the because the DGA is pretty protective of those things.
Yeah.
But that is, there's no like appeals process or anything. They get to say what goes. Of course, we don't know if Lord Miller would want to take their name off or something. Probably not, because then they don't get residuals. And I would want residuals from a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
Even if I had to swallow my pride a little bit.
Yeah. There's, you know, there's some things to stand up for your pride for, and then there's like $500 million or whatever, and it's like, you know what, it's not worth it. Take the money.
Yeah. Well, think of all the movies we could make for that.
Exactly.
Yeah. But let's talk about some of... Well, I don't know how to take this. I mean, let's just start with the solid fact, which is Ron Howard is taking this over. That seems like a weird choice.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm not, like, super deeply familiar with his stuff as a director. Like, I'm aware of him as a director, but I've never gone and be like, I'm going to watch a Ron Howard movie and be, like, really cognizant of the fact that he made one, even though he's made good movies.
Yeah, I mean, he's not, you know, what you would call an auteur. He's not someone who you can, like, look at his movies and say, that is very definitely a Ron Howard movie or something like that. He's more of a journeyman director. He's done lots of different genres and styles, sometimes exquisitely. Mm-hmm. A couple years ago, he did that movie with Chris Hemsworth and the guy from Inglourious Basterds, the German guy, whatever his name is, called Rush.
Oh, yeah.
And no one saw it. It's phenomenal. I think it's maybe my favorite Ron Howard movie. It's a great little racing movie. And it is just stupendously directed and shot and everything. And so he can make things that I think are just muscular works of cinema like that, and then on to what I think is the worst movie maybe to ever win Best Picture at the Oscars, A Beautiful Mind.
Yeah, right, yes.
Which
yes.
is a pile of hot garbage.
Yeah, I have seen that one.
Yeah, we had to watch that in a psych class together. Uh-huh. That's a terrible movie. So he can make like really treacly bullshit, and he can make really interesting technical stuff, and he can do little dramas. There's that movie Frost Nixon, which is a filmed version of the play, but it's still very well directed. You know, he's a solid director. There's nothing in his filmography that suggests Star Wars to me. What it is that I think he's friends with Kathleen Kennedy and the people at Lucasfilm.
Nah.
And it's like, okay, we can depend on this guy. He'll do what we want him to do, and whatever, you know.
Because it seems like a big part of that situation is wanting to make sure that the director you get is going to do what you want that person to do.
Yeah.
Because, like, all the reports about why they fired Lord Miller was that they were not doing what LucasArts wanted them to do.
Yeah. And, you know, with that in mind, Ron Howard makes sense because he is old and, you know, set enough as a director that he's not going to take a career hit from this. It looks a little desperate to me, but then you think, like, it's Ron Howard. No one's going to hold this against him or say it's a brilliant move or anything. He's just going to keep being Ron Howard, you know?
Yeah.
So you get that, but he's also not going to, like, rock the boat. He's going to do what they want him to do, and he'll, you know, make probably a solid version of whatever they want him to shoot. And I guess that's probably the best case scenario, because you're probably not going to get, like, a young up-and-comer to want to do this, because that would be a terrible, weird scenario to walk into. But it just winds up feeling like, I never thought we were going to see a Ron Howard directed Star Wars movie, and the thought of the, you know, safe, you know, secure Ron Howard directed Han Solo spinoff sounds awful to me.
Yeah, right. Like,
because let's get into the details that we're hearing. The Hollywood Reporter and Variety both had different stories on this, and I would recommend reading them. There's some very good reporting in there. But really, what it comes down to is that Miller and Lord thought they were shooting a comedy. Which, to be fair, if I were making a Han Solo spinoff, that's what I would make.
Yes.
I would not make the reverent Star Wars movie because I don't think that would work. But anyway, they were kind of making a comedy. They were using sort of their own kind of improvisational style. They were not shooting it like you would shoot a giant mega blockbuster. And again, to me, that sounds kind of like an interesting approach to this sort of material.
And it sounds like, of course, that's like they're making the movie the way they want to make it, how they make movies.
Right.
And they've been successful at making movies that way with Lego Movie and 21 Jump Street. And presumably that is why Lucasfilm and Disney wanted them in the first place to make this movie.
Yeah.
So it's like, they should have known that's what you're getting into if you're getting these guys.
Yeah, so very weird that they didn't see that coming, I guess. Yeah. But Kathleen Kennedy, the producer at Lucasfilm, didn't like what they were making. And more importantly, Lawrence Kasdan, who is the writer on this film and obviously storied Hollywood writer, wrote Empire Strikes Back, you know, famous Star Wars person, did not like what they were doing. He wrote the Han Solo movie along with his son, Jake Kasdan, and was very unhappy with the way dailies were turning out because he felt they weren't being... He thought they were going to shoot his script verbatim. Again, I don't think you hire these guys to shoot your script verbatim, but whatever. And didn't like that. And, you know, I guess he went out to set and was even trying to, like, kind of exert some influence. But you really, under DGA rules, you can't just kick them off and let Lawrence Kasdan direct the movie because that's there's a reason you can't do that, because it would be abusive to directors and all this stuff. So finally, they just decided, fuck it, we're firing you guys, and we're going to get the movie we want. And there were other problems throughout production. The editor on the film was fired. That's a little weird to me that you fire an editor midway through production.
Yeah.
What, like, you know, maybe I'm stupid about the process of movie making. Obviously, some editing does go on throughout the process, so you can put things together and see how it's working out. I just don't know how you would know if the editing is working out or not at that phase.
Yeah.
But whatever, they replaced him with another editor. Both, like, Oscar-winning editors, so that's a little weird. Alden Ehrenreich, whatever his name is, who's playing Han Solo, who, again, I think is interesting casting, because if you haven't seen Hail Caesar by the Coens, you should watch Hail Caesar by the Coens. But anyway, Miller and Lord, I think, liked what he was doing, but Kennedy and Kasdan did not, so they hired an acting coach for him midway through production, which is a very weird step. Actors have acting coaches all the time, but it's usually a pre-production thing.
Right.
Or, you know, you carry over from pre-production into production, so that's a little odd. So all these things were going on, and yeah, and finally they decided that was it. They kicked him to the curb and got Ron Howard in, and he will presumably shoot exactly what they want him to shoot, and we will get a safe, boring, reverent, which is the word we kept hearing thrown around, that Kennedy did not want anyone making light of Star Wars. And we'll get that, and that'll be probably not a good movie.
Yeah, that will also, like, it'll be, like, whatever percentage of it shot by Ron Howard and whatever, like, they salvage from the Lord and Miller version of the movie, which just feels like, I mean, you know, it, maybe it's a good thing that they fired the original editor already and got, like, their own editor on board. It's just like, that feels like that's going to be the nightmare job on that production at some point. It's like, how do you take all this shit and tie it together into one movie?
It really is. And, you know, I think we've seen too much hate out there online for Kathleen Kennedy and stuff like that. She's a very smart person. She's a good producer. I do think this just speaks to a fundamental mistake in this whole production, which is, why do you hire two directors who are a known quantity? These guys have, this is not like their first movie. They've made movies before. Why do you hire a known quantity and not want them to do what they do?
Exactly.
That's just bizarre to me. That's bad management. And, you know, we've had some bad management on the Star Wars movies before, with everything that happened on Rogue One and stuff. But you can at least excuse that as that was Gareth Edwards' second big budget movie or something like that.
Right.
You know, he's not as a known a quantity. Again, you hire two well-known comedy directors. They try making a comedy. I don't understand. Just from the outside, this looks like such a clusterfuck.
Yeah, and it just, it's one of those things where you look at it and it just, it's interesting, I think, to sort of compare and contrast, like, what we know now, like, about how the Star Wars movies are being handled, and then also how, like, the Marvel movies are being handled, because obviously they're both under the Disney umbrella, but they're sort of separate entities. You know, it's Lucasfilm and Marvel Studios, and it's you're seeing, like, how huge of an influence the producer, like, arm of those studios are in, like, not just sort of picking directors and, like, helping along, like, pre-production and all that stuff, but, like, deciding the whole tone and direction and everything of those films, to the point where you're straight up fucking firing your directors. Like, that's an interesting, I don't know, it's interesting to see how I feel like the Marvel movies sort of more started in that camp, it felt like, and now have been getting more experimental, moving into, like, Guardians and stuff like that, and allowing your directors to sort of take on their own tone and make very much their own kinds of movies. And Star Wars, at least right now, feels like they are very locked down into exactly, like, this specific kind of Star Wars movie and kind of Star Wars tone that they want.
And it's, yeah, it's weird. And you would look at Marvel. Kevin Feige runs a really tight ship. They have had two problematic productions out of, like, 20 now. And that's Thor: The Dark World, which lost Patty Jenkins and then got Alan Taylor and then did reshoots, apparently written by Joss Whedon, because he does that a lot now, I guess.
Yeah.
And then you had Ant-Man, which, you know, again, didn't go into production with Edgar Wright, but was very close to it. And actually, there was an interesting nugget in the Hollywood Reporter story on Star Wars mentioning Ant-Man as kind of, it's the kind of the closest allegory we have right now. Although, again, Edgar Wright didn't roll film on Ant-Man.
Yeah.
That was all Peyton Reed actually shot the movie. And, you know, part of it with Ant-Man was apparently Kevin Feige was kind of fighting for Edgar Wright's version of the movie. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it did come from on high at Disney. Like, no, we're not going out on that far on a limb with a movie called Ant-Man. And I can kind of understand that.
Yeah.
Even if I, you know, and I like the Ant-Man final product we got. I would love to live in a world where Edgar Wright got to do his thing on it, but whatever. So it's interesting to compare and contrast these cases, and it is, I think the people at Lucasfilm are going to have to decide if you want real directors to come in and, like, make your Star Wars movies and do their thing, you just have to let them do it,
yeah,
kind of come what may. And if you just want sort of safe Star Wars-y movies, then there's a different kind of filmmaker you go for. And it is interesting, like, Rian Johnson, who's making Episode 8, is a guy with a really strong voice, and apparently Episode 8 has gone off without a hitch and is a pretty special Star Wars movie, and maybe that's just a case where the voices melded very, very well.
Yeah.
But kind of, other than Episode 7, everything else they've been doing has encountered a lot of problems, so that's interesting.
Yeah. And it's just, it's also, it's, as a Star Wars fan, it's disappointing to me to have them, like, locked down, and we'll see like what it's like when the actual movie comes out, because I'm really like, I want to see this movie now more to like just understand what the finished product is going to be than I am in actually like the premise and the sort of narrative promise of what this movie is going to be. But like, to me, the idea of having your like every single year you have a Star Wars movie is like you flip off every year that is like one is your big main Episode 7, 8, 9, blah 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 whatever to like Episode 1 billion or whatever however far we're going to go, and then every other year it's the Star Wars story model, presuming they're going to keep those that title structure from Rogue One, where you have your spin-offs that get to be a little bit more adventurous. It's not like Rogue One was not some like dramatically different kind of thing from other Star Wars movies, but it was a little bit darker. It was a little bit more of a war movie, even though every Star Wars movie is a war movie when you break it down. Like, every Star Wars movie revolves around, in the climax, a giant war conflict. So it's like...
It's in the title.
Yeah, it's like not that different when you really break down to it, but it was a little bit different, and it felt like... Getting Lord and Miller for your Young Han Solo movie, which they still have not titled, and that's annoying because we have to fucking call it the Young Han Solo movie, and to the point where that sounds like it's a movie about Han Solo becoming like a rapper or something. Yo, I'm Young Han Solo. But it's like the promise of having Lord and Miller be able to tackle that and bring a very different kind of tone to the Star Wars films, a tone that has already existed in Star Wars cartoons and comic books and video games and novels and stuff that have been way more adventurous with the source material. That was really exciting to me because it's like, you get to have your cake and eat it too. You get your reverent or whatever main big blockbuster Star Wars movies that like carry on the story and all that stuff and are, you know, very safe in sort of what they're trying to do. And then you just get the like, fucking whatever, we'll just go for it, like get a cool director, let them kind of go buck wild with whatever premise they have.
Because frankly, at a certain point, that makes more business sense to me too.
Yeah.
Because if you're pitching every Star Wars movie as the same thing, they're not all going to do the same at the box office. We saw that with Rogue One versus Episode 7. Rogue One was a hugely successful movie, but worldwide grossed about half of what The Force, maybe a little less than, more than half, but you know, it did like $1.3 billion or something, and Force Awakens was $2.3 billion, I don't know. So clearly I think, and I would assume Episode 8 is going to get back to like that $2 billion marker. I think it'll have that excitement, especially, you know, they have Mark Hamill to market with it and stuff right. Like that. So, you know, we'll see, but if you're going to assume those off-year movies are just naturally going to be smaller grosses anyway, then I would do smaller budgets, bigger risks, and see what you can kind of grow organically in those years,
yeah.
And have fun with that. I mean, frankly, I think a smart move at this point would be for Lucasfilm to extend kind of an olive branch to the team doing all the animation stuff with Rebels ending and everything, and just
yeah.
Say, not like, stop doing that and come work on our stuff, but like, maybe have them be part of a story team, or a
yeah.
Brain trust, or something, just to like, they're really good at Star Wars.
Yes.
Have them try to come up with like, what are ways we can get this thing moving? Because they're storytellers, and clearly what they've done for Star Wars has been pretty successful for the past decade plus.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just... I think there are ways you could do this and be creative with it. But...
Yeah, me too. It's just like, I want interesting Star Wars movies, and an interesting Star Wars movie to me is not like the same Star Wars movie over and over again. Because Star Wars is a franchise that is very rich. Like, there are a lot of different kinds of stories you can tell, lots of different kinds of characters, lots of different tones you can have. It can be funny and goofy, like C-3PO R2-D2 style, or it can be, like, very heavy drama, like, over-the-top drama, like Luke and Darth Vader and the Emperor on the Death Star. You know, like, you have, like, they are wildly varying tones, even in just the movies we already have. And I think, like, forgetting that and going for, like, the most, like, middle-of-the-line standard Star Wars experience every single time is the most boring thing you could possibly do.
Here's what I want. Big risk.
Yeah.
Everyone says Jar Jar Binks was kind of racist.
Okay.
So, let's steer into that.
Okay?
Spike Lee makes a Star Wars Jar Jar Binks movie, like a Do the Right Thing remake, but with Jar Jar.
Okay.
I think that would be fascinating.
Sure.
The racial injustice in outer space.
I just want to see what, like the second, Like, even before you get anything of that pitch you just said, like, the second you say Jar Jar Binks movie, it's like 500 million people have already stormed, like, the Disney headquarters and murdered everybody there. Like, it's already, you've just, like, destroyed one of the most, like, successful massive corporations in the world with, like, a phrase.
And it's, since it's Spike Lee, you get Samuel L. Jackson in there. He can still be Mace Windu, but he can play him cool this time.
Okay, yeah, sure, yeah. Yes. No, now you have just hit on the perfect thing, which is Spike Lee directs a, like, racially charged, like, racially interested buddy cop movie with Mace Windu and Jar Jar Binks.
I'd love it.
Yes.
Ahmed Best is always there to play Jar Jar Binks.
Yes, he is. He that man is up for it.
Yes. He is indefatigable about this. Absolutely. All right. Speaking of movies that are probably going to be bad.
Okay.
I just want to make fun of this because it was all over social media. Jurassic World announced the Jurassic World 2 title.
Yes.
And they were really proud of it because, man, they plastered it everywhere.
Which this would, just to put in context, this is would be the sixth Jurassic Park movie or the fifth?
Okay. Jurassic World is the fourth.
Okay.
With Jurassic Park, The Lost World, Jurassic Park 3, and Jurassic World. And let me remind you, each movie is worse than the last one. And I know some people say, no, Jurassic World was... No, fuck you. The Lost World is still a Steven Spielberg movie. It is better than your shitty Jurassic World, which is horrible. Anyway, the new one is called Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. And I legitimately had to look up, was that a PS2 spin-off game?
Yeah, or like the mobile tie-in game, or the novel or something. Like the not like the like proper like Crichton novels, like... The movie tie-in novel spinoff that you get like some like hungry young author to write for you.
Yeah. Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. What happened to titles in Hollywood? Why are they so bad at it?
I don't know.
I don't get it.
I mean, I get that it's like, you know, if you're in that awkward position where do you call it just Jurassic World 2 when there's already... Oh, but because they've never... Is the only one they've numbered Jurassic Park 3?
Yeah. Because The Lost World is called The Lost World Jurassic Park, but not Jurassic Park 2.
Yeah. So... You're in a weird spot with the numbering. Like, sins have already been committed in this franchise.
I want them to keep going out Jurassic Universe, or Jurassic Galaxy next, Jurassic Universe.
Well, no, it's Jurassic Galaxy, then Jurassic Galactic Cluster, and then it's Jurassic Universe, and then it's, like, Jurassic Multiverse, I guess?
And just think of how, because that was the biggest disappointment about Jurassic World, is it's really just a warmed-over remake of Jurassic Park, and they didn't do anything with the, like, world. They don't go on a worldwide trek with the dinosaurs. I want them to go nuts with it, you know? And they're not going to. I can predict the plot to this sequel.
Okay.
They think the dinosaurs are safe, like, in a cage, and then the dinosaurs get out and kill people. Movie.
Okay. Is Jeff Goldblum going to be in this one?
He is, actually. Okay, Have you heard about that?
Yes, yeah.
So, we'll see. Speaking of titles, I forgot to say, with the Han Solo movie, we still don't have a title.
Yeah.
The one way they could redeem my excitement for this movie is I need it to be called Goin' Solo, a Star Wars story. Or Flyin' Solo. I'm okay with either of those, but I want it to be a pun on his name.
Where you can't tell, is this the title for the new Star Wars movie, or is this Harrison Ford's new autobiography?
About killing all his favorite characters.
Yeah, Flyin' Solo, a Star Wars story.
Yes. I just think it would be great.
Yeah.
Goin' Solo or Flyin' Solo might also be the name of one of Roald Dahl's autobiographies.
Yeah.
I forget, but it's one of them.
What about Give Me a Han, a Star Wars story? Like, Give Me a Hand, like Give Me a Hand.
I would also accept Han and Chewie's Excellent Adventure, a Star Wars story.
Okay, good, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of... It's probably just going to be called Han Solo, a Star Wars story. But there's so many creative ways to do this.
And if they just call it Han Solo, a Star Wars story, that would be such a bummer.
Or Young Han Solo, and then we can at least do the rap mashup videos.
Young Han Solo. Young Han.
I'm Young Han Solo, and I'm here to say, me and Chewie are here to stay.
Okay. That didn't even fit, like... The scheme, but okay.
No, I'm white. I can't do this.
Okay, let's move on.
All right. Wonder Woman. We like that movie.
Yes.
I just wanted to say this because it made me laugh. I think as of now, it was within a, like, 10 million of this, has outgrossed every other DCEU film domestically at the box office. That includes Batman v Superman, Suicide Squad, and Man of Steel. And it might not outgross all of those worldwide, but I like that domestically Americans chose Wonder Woman. That redeems us a little bit.
Well, it just turns out when you make a movie that's not, like, the most fucking offensive, terrible dog shit anyone's ever gone to see in a movie theater in, like, five decades, you people go and see the good one. They go and say, like, hey, this is an actual good movie. Then the other people will go see that movie instead of the other strategy they had, which is we have these, like, tremendously popular characters and, like, people that are desperate to see these movies for some reason, and then a bunch of them are going to go see that movie, like, right when it opens, and then nobody's ever going to see it again because it's complete horrible dog shit.
Yeah. No, I mean, it has been cool, though. Like, it has had very small drops week to week at the box office. It's been a word-of-mouth success. Like, it's honestly the rare Hollywood blockbuster that is also a genuine word-of-mouth hit.
Yeah.
And that's really cool, I think, for this specific movie. And really, I just want like, Warner Brothers to look at those numbers and say, we're canceling everything not to do with Wonder Woman and starting over.
Yeah.
That Aquaman movie can come, too. It looks okay.
Maybe, sure.
Yeah. But, you know, other than that, you stop all the other stuff.
Yeah. They're not going to do that, though.
You know what's funny? One of the original sets of directors on The Flash that quit was Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Yeah, because they left to go do Young Han Solo the movie, the Star Wars story.
Maybe they're going to come back and do The Flash.
And then like, the Warner Brothers, like, kicks them off of that movie and fires them halfway through. They're like, why are you making a funny Flash movie? What the fuck are you doing? They're like, oh, I guess. And then they go and try to work on another Star Wars movie. And they get kicked off of that project. And they just bounce between, like, two studios.
Why isn't Barry Allen cutting himself in this movie? It needs to be dark. Barry Allen is a sad character.
Exactly. It's The Flash. He's the most, like, dark, depressing, grim superhero in the world. I mean, come on. Look at the guy. He's dressed in bright red with, like, yellow highlights. What could be more depressing than that?
I think just a lot of the people at DC need some antidepressants.
Yeah.
Maybe that would fix everything. We just send them some Xanax, some Lexapro. They'll be okay. All right. Nintendo had a big announcement this week.
They did.
Completely out of the blue, as they do. Nintendo got a Nintendo.
Yeah. Weird that this did not come up anywhere at E3, which happened, like, fucking 2 weeks ago. Or 2 years ago, depending on how you measure time.
The long-rumored Super NES Classic Edition has been announced.
Yeah.
It will be out September 29th, 2017. Yes. It will cost $80. Yes. It will come with 21 games, one of which has never seen the light of day, and that is the...
Well, it has never officially seen the light of day.
And not in finished form.
Technically in finished form.
All the ones that are, like, out there, the developers, you know, estimate are, like, 80% finished. We will be seeing on this the finished build of Star Fox 2, the game that Nintendo completed but never released because they were scared it wouldn't look as good next to the N64. Yeah. And so Star Fox 2 will be getting its debut on here, meaning it will be eligible for top 10 lists. I just want to say that. It is a 2017 game.
It will be eligible.
If it's really good.
It will be eligible.
I want some big Star Fox fan to put that on their list. Anyway.
Hopefully there's retitling, you know, Young Fox McCloud, a Star Fox story. Yeah. But
It will come with two controllers with it, which is kind of nice. You don't
each,
have to go...
each controller has a 5-foot wire length, which everybody noted because the NES Classic had a 3-foot wire length, which 5 feet still isn't that long for, like, the size of most people's televisions, but...
Whatever, better.
It's better. They're slowly making their, like, once they do the N64 Classic, then it'll be, like, a reasonable 7-foot length controller wire, and then everyone will be fine with it.
Maybe they'll just be wireless by then.
Maybe, yeah.
Anyway, and Nintendo has also promised to journalists, we're going to make more of these, don't worry. Now, here's the thing. When you multiply the number zero, it stays zero. I'm still not convinced anyone actually bought an NES Classic, so I'm also not convinced anyone's going to be able to get an SNES Classic, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Actually, one of our listeners who lives in Australia already got an NES Classic pre-order, because in Australia, I guess Nintendo of that, like Nintendo
the NOA of Australia.
I think it's NOE. I think it's under NOE. I might be wrong on that. But that division of Nintendo is much better at pre-orders and stuff, so they were able to get one. Good for you. In America, we're probably fucked. But anyway, we'll see. I would kind of like to get one of these, but we will find out. Let's go through the list of games really quick.
Yeah, it is a very solid list of games. Oh, Super Nintendo has a great library.
Yeah, you can scoop up 20 Super NES games and have all hits, and that was what they have done. We have Contra 3, The Alien Wars.
Sure.
Donkey Kong Country. Not the Alien Wars. Earthbound, which it's kind of amazing to just see this casually on there, because for years you just couldn't get that in the States. Yeah. Like, it was hard. Now we've got Final Fantasy III, which is actually 6, but this will be the 3 version from the Super NES. F-Zero, Kirby Superstar, Kirby's Dream Course. Kirby, the only Nintendo character other than Fox who gets 2 games on this.
Well, like, at least they're, like, they are 2 very different games. Yes, they are. Like, the first one is a side-scroller, the second one is, like, a golfing game or some shit.
Apparently a great one. I had never heard of it. The Legend of Zelda Link to the Past, because if they didn't, that'd be weird.
Yeah.
Mega Man X.
Sure.
Secret of Mana. Star Fox 2, I am genuinely excited about that. Street Fighter 2 Turbo Hyper Fighting, because there's got to be some version of Street Fighter 2.
I guess, yeah. I don't know if there's anybody really interested in playing the Super Nintendo version of Street Fighter 2 these days, but...
it's on there.
I mean, they recently sold that weird, shitty version of Street Fighter 2 for the Nintendo Switch for like $40 or something, so...
yeah. Now we have 8 games with Super in the title.
Okay.
Super Castlevania 4.
Yes.
Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
Okay, yeah.
Super Mario Kart.
Yeah.
Super Mario RPG Legend of the Seven Stars.
Yes.
Super Mario World. Uh-huh. Super Mario World 2 Yoshi's Island.
Right, yes, okay, yes. It is called over here Super Mario World 2 for reasons nobody will ever be able to understand.
Super Metroid and Super Punch-Out.
Okay, yeah.
That's a solid list of games.
I always forget that Super Punch-Out exists. I always just think of Punch-Out, Punch-Out.
Honestly, there are a couple holes in that lineup. Chrono Trigger, I think, is probably the most obvious gap.
Sure, yeah.
That said, they do have a lot of Square Enix games, and there probably is an upper limit on how many they can get from Square onto this, so probably made the right choices. The other one, I would say... if you're going to pick between Final Fantasy 2 and 3, a lot of people would pick 3. I wish both 2 and 3 were on there. And the Donkey Kong Country sequels, I think it's weird, are not on there.
But sure.
Other than that...
especially because it's like... like, you could fucking put 30 games on this thing and, like, whatever. Like, it's one of the things that makes it weird is that the fact that they have not announced... more in-depth what their plans for classic games on the Nintendo Switch are makes this a weird thing to me in some ways.
I agree.
Because it's like... I guess $80 for these 20 games is fine. I don't know. Like, it's hard to sort of, like, figure out what is an acceptable pricing for games that are, like, 20 years old at this point.
It's less than half as much as you would pay for, like, those 21 games, or just the 20, I think is how I calculated it, if you were paying the $8 Nintendo tends to charge for these.
Yeah, which is $8 is too much for a Super Nintendo game, I think, but...
yeah, but, you know, I think... I am of mixed opinions, because obviously I would more like the announcement that these 21 games are coming to the Switch. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
But we didn't get that. I do think the Super NES is a cool enough console. That is a cool enough lineup of games. The Star Fox 2 of it all is very exciting. It's got two controllers. If I could pick one of these up for $80 with minimal effort, I would love to and just have that, and it would be a fun way to play some of my favorite games and just have them on that little collection. At the same time, yeah, I would rather hear about Virtual Console. The Switch needs to have those games on it because it would be awesome. And yeah, it's a weird scenario. The biggest thing for me is the NES Classic was such an unmitigated disaster in terms of people actually getting it.
Yeah.
In no way do I trust Nintendo to handle this rollout well. They've done decently with the Switch, to their credit. It's not been the utter clusterfuck it could have been.
Right.
The Switch is still in high demand, but it's also early enough in that console's lifespan. We can kind of forgive that.
Yeah.
This kind of thing, like, this should be, you go into Best Buy and you can just pick one up. And it's probably not going to be that.
No.
And that's going to be frustrating. Because as much as I love Super Nintendo in these games, most of the ones that I love on here and that I've already played at least, I do own in a couple places.
Yeah, and then, like, a lot of these have, like, a lot of these games have much better versions of them that have been made after. That, like, would be, like, I would rather play, like, my Game Boy Advance cart of Link to the Past than play it on this thing, you know? Like I think that, like, that's one of the things. Or, like, Street Fighter 2 is the big one. Why would you ever play this fucking Super Nintendo? Like, obviously, when it came out, awesome. Like, Street Fighter 2 on the Super Nintendo, like, this is an arcade fighting game, and playing it on your Super Nintendo, like, that's fine. Now, it's like... no? Like, that's a weird... that's a weird bad version of that game compared to, like, other versions of that game you could easily play.
Yeah. So, I don't know. If Nintendo hadn't made this such a big deal with the NES Classic and the fake shortages...
yeah.
I don't think anyone... you would be like, okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
And you'd move on. But when it's like people are going to be fighting over these things, that annoys me. Especially because... at a certain point, you look at the NES Classic, you look at this, and you look at the silence about Virtual Console on the Switch, and you're like, fuckers, put those games on your actual consoles.
Yeah.
I love these games so much, but I also, like, the holy trinity of Metroid, Link to the Past, and Mario World, I own on both 3DS and Wii U. Another couple of these Super NES games I own in other places. And there are ones on here I have not played before, but I would love to. And there are other ones that are not easily available on virtual consoles these days, like all the Square games. That is still one of the best versions of Final Fantasy III. And it's very hard, you know, unless you have a Super NES cart or want to play it on the original Wii virtual console by plugging in a classic controller, which most people don't want to do. That's kind of a hard version of that game to get. But, you know, I just don't know if that's enough to, again, make me fight for it. I'd be fine going and dropping my $80 and enjoying it It's just all the surrounding rigmarole that pisses me off with it.
Yeah.
And who knows? Maybe Nintendo will have learned their lesson.
Maybe.
Probably not.
I don't know. Like, yeah.
I still think they fell asleep in econ class on supply and demand day, and somehow they've made it this far in business without anyone filling them in on the details.
Yeah. I still think it's just one of the things that's most baffling about this is that they didn't have this at their E3 thing. Like, there was more than enough room for you to be able to have that announcement there, and it would not have, like, I think, overshadowed their other announcements.
No. The Star Fox 2 thing is cool.
That's cool.
Unearthing a lost game that was done but never released and saying, hey, we're going to have that on here. This is neat. I like the original Super NES version of Star Fox an awful lot. It's obviously very primitive in its graphics, but I do enjoy playing it. It's also the only actual Star Fox sequel that was ever made, because otherwise they're all remakes of the original Star Fox.
Hey, Star Fox Adventure is not a remake of Star Fox.
No one considers it a main Star Fox game either,
Maybe you don't.
Anyway.
It's the only main... Everything else is the spin-off. The fucking Dinosaur Island Adventures. That's the real game.
All right, you want to move...
That's the true canon of Star Fox.
You want to move on?
Okay, let's move on.
You want to talk some Doctor Who?
Let's talk about Doctor Who.
Today, we are talking about the penultimate episode of Series 10 of Doctor Who.
Finally making the sequel after over 50 years.
The anti-penultimate episode for Peter Capaldi and Stephen Moffat.
Yeah.
World Enough and Time. I love that title.
It's a very good title.
By Stephen Moffat. Spoilers from here on out. In which, among other things, we saw the origin of the Mondasian Cybermen.
Yes.
Bill was murdered and turned into a Mondasian Cyberman.
Yeah, that happened.
John Sim was in the entire episode in makeup, only to be revealed in the final minutes that he was the Master all along.
Yeah, it's very good.
Missy and the Master meet. And, oh, we saw the 12th Doctor's regeneration.
Oh, right, yes. Or at least part of it. Part of it at the beginning of the episode. Yeah.
In an episode that I think was outstandingly directed by Rachel Talalay,
yeah,
who has been the star director of this era of Doctor Who. Another just home run for the production design team.
Absolutely,
on that ship. Great acting from everyone involved. Great music from Murray Gold, who actually did some deep cuts bringing back like themes from the 10th Doctor Master episodes, which I rewatched recently. They're better than I remembered. And I think also a very, very solid script from Stephen Moffat. Although it is very much a part one. More so than I think we've gotten in recent years with Doctor Who. But it's a really damn good part one.
Yeah. That I think, like, the dramatic structure of it is so strong that even though, like, yes, it is definitely a lot of setup for stuff that we paid off next episode, I think, like, it is just so perfectly paced in and of itself that it's like, entirely enjoyable on its own, even if you don't get the narrative payoff. You get... And I got, like, a tremendous satisfaction just out of the sort of the story it tells about Bill in this episode, because I think that's maybe, like, the place to start with it, is that it is Bill's episode. The Doctor's not even in it that much, which I thought was interesting and like, worked really well, how they, like, went about it, switching between the two timelines and everything.
It is Bill's episode, and it is a dark fucking episode.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, here's something to start with. My brother, Thomas, had kind of missed this season so far, but he does watch Doctor Who. He often does this where kind of he waits until the season is done and then watches it all.
Sure.
But he wanted to kind of catch up for the finale because, you know, big things are going to be happening on Doctor Who soon. And so he's been watching through the episodes, and he has picked every episode. I've asked him about it, and he's like, this is really dark. And I think when you're watching them all together, I think I totally get that. And we've commented on it, but also week to week you can focus on the lighter moments and stuff. But yes, every episode this season to a certain degree, and maybe with the exception of stuff like Empress of Mars and The Lie of the Land, which are the two weak links this season, has taken sort of a traditional Doctor Who structure and done at least one subversion with it, or two layers of subversion or something. And each episode, like he noted, like in the premiere, hey, they didn't save that girl. They didn't figure out what happened to her. That doesn't usually happen on Doctor Who. And in the second episode, man, a lot of people died in that colony base. And in the third episode, man, that kid just died. And in the fourth episode, all those kids just died. And in the fifth episode, the Doctor went blind. Like, this has been, I think, especially now that we're nearing the home stretch and Stephen Moffat is leaning as hard as he physically can into the darkness, this has been a dark run. Yeah. And this is a particularly dark episode. And what do you think about that?
I like it. I think it works really well because it's a season that feels like, generally speaking, most of the episodes do not have very like clean resolutions. Or even when they have a cleaner resolution like last week's episode. That's like, it resolves sort of more concretely, but it also resolves by having like all these characters go off into like a like alternate dimension where they're going to live out their lives, like fighting these alien monsters and dying eventually. They just, you know, all that torment happens off screen in that episode instead of you just seeing it all directly.
And there's a lot of dark stuff building up to it.
Yeah, because, yeah, they also, like, the monster kills, like, a million fucking Roman soldiers or something ridiculous like that before the episode starts. And so it is definitely a darker season. And this is, like, has what has got to be the darkest image in Doctor Who history of, I mean, Bill gets shot through the chest and you have a full-on, like, frontal shot where you see her head and the hole in her chest, like, in the same frame, which is a pretty intense shot for a family-oriented show to go for. Like, I did not think that they would... Like, I like companions have died in the past, but it's like, when Adric died, it was, like, totally off-screen. It was totally, like, you know, he's in a spaceship that's crashing, and it's, like, it's about to crash, and you cut away, and it's, like, it's an intense ending to an episode, but it's, like, you don't see, like, Adric's, like, fucking mangled corpse. The closest thing I can think of is in the Daleks' master plan, the first, like, sort of quote-unquote companion death, even though I don't, she's only around for, like, two episodes, so I don't count her as a companion, but some people do. But there's this Katarina character that technically carries over from the Mythmakers serial into the Daleks Master Plan serial in the first Doctor's run. And in, like, I think the second or third episode of Daleks Master Plan, she's killed by, like, accidentally basically being ejected out into space from an airlock without a spacesuit. And so she just suffocates in the nothingness of space, which it's like, first Doctor, it's like, you know, mid-60s production values. It's not like this really intense scene, but it's like, conceptually, it's pretty dark. And this feels like it is kind of in that space of like, oh, fuck. Like, you're like, you're going for it. You're not shying away from what you're doing to this character.
Yeah, it's really dark. I mean, it's more the Dragon Ball Z version of that image than, like, a body horror version of it where you have, like, guts and stuff. But it is, no, you're totally... there's a hole in the middle of our beloved companion, Bill, who, again, we've only had her for 11 episodes. We all really love Bill.
Yes,
she's a great companion.
Absolutely.
This is not a boring companion. This is a wonderful companion. But I think, to me, why I started by kind of framing the darkness of this episode is... in a vacuum, this episode is dark.
Right.
As episode 11 of this season, I think it's extra dark because I think it's all of a piece. And I think that's a credit to this season. But Stephen Moffat has chosen to go, I think, in a very unexpectedly dark direction this year. And I really do think the underlying theme and subtext of this entire season is the Doctor is in a pretty abusive relationship with Bill. Yeah. I think Bill is his friend, but I think he uses Bill... I think all doctors use their companions to a certain degree, and that is a persistent theme on Doctor Who. I think this season is more self-aware of that than ever, in that, yes, Bill and the Doctor have chemistry, they are buddies, they get along, but I think for the Doctor, at least, it's a really codependent thing where he keeps putting Bill in danger to the point where she keeps almost dying, like, over and over. And not almost dying in the way companions normally almost die, but she also almost got sucked out into the vacuum of space.
Yeah.
You know, and the Doctor was able to sacrifice part of his body for that, but there's no guarantee that he could have saved her. And this time, he very much did not save her.
Yeah.
She just gets fucking shot in the chest because... And they even the way they do it, I love, where he starts making a speech. And one, this is, we can talk about how marketing was used in this episode overall, because it's an interesting conversation. One thing is that the speech he starts to make was recorded in full somewhere, because it's in the trailers.
Yeah, I remembered when he started saying it, that it was like the speech from the original Next Time trailer at the end of the pilot episode this season.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like, the whole thing about, like, I will leave and you will always wonder who I was, like, that speech. Yeah, like, halfway through it, the gunshot happens.
Yeah. So his speech doesn't work. He was cocky in putting Missy in there. He was cocky in staying out. He was cocky in not checking out this area. And Bill just got fucking shot.
Yeah.
And not only that, Bill then lives out like a decade of her life with a weird Russian dude.
Yeah.
Who is nice to her overall until it turns out he's an asshole.
Yeah.
And then gets turned into the first Mondasian Cyberman. I mean... has anything that dark ever happened on Doctor Who?
Not on the main TV show, no. Like, I mean, definitely not.
Again, like, this whole season is a Big Finish season, basically, right?
Sure, yeah. Like, definitely, it felt like there's some pretty fucked up Big Finish audio dramas, and this feels like it is sort of... I mean, because one of the other sort of version of the Mondasian Cyberman origin story is the, like, heavily acclaimed Spare Parts Big Finish Audio Drama, which is you're going to watch like or listen to one Big Finish Audio Drama, it would either be like Chimes of Midnight with the Eighth Doctor or Spare Parts with the Fifth Doctor, because it's just incredible. And this is definitely pulling from that in terms of like the tone and style more than like the literal plot of it. But yeah, it is a dark, very intense episode. That is, as you said, it's pulling from the larger sort of structure and themes of this whole season, which is a lot of the Doctor being in this weird position. I think like the position he's in and like the weird relationship he has with the Master over the course of the season, with her being locked behind this door and him like being very antsy of being sort of tied to one place, which we know he does not like to do. And like him being in this like position of maybe being able to reclaim this like friendship that is so like tremendous and valuable and like long lived for him in a way that like we can't quite understand, because you know we only live for like 100 years if we're incredibly lucky and then we're dead. And it's like these are two Time Lords, and they have done a good job with the Missy stuff, I think, emphasizing that part of their relationship, not just in this season but in the last season and in season 8 when she's introduced. And so that position the Doctor's in of being like really antsy, really kind of like off of his game in some ways because of this sort of like this tantalizing thing he has right next to him of this like friend that can maybe actually understand him, means that he's not paying attention to everything he should be paying attention to. And like you said, he has this sort of weirdly abusive relationship with Bill, where in some ways like can be a sort of a normal doctor companion relationship, but then also he's kind of using her as a tool in a lot of ways to be able to get away and have fun, and she's like an excuse for that. Or here he just uses her literally as like a pawn so that she can be with the Master Missy and see how this scenario is going to unfold when he's not right there to make sure everything's going to be fine the way he would in a normal episode of Doctor Who.
Yeah, I don't think Stephen Moffat is also unaware of the framing of this, that it's a professor-student relationship.
Right.
I don't think that's accidental. I think there's not a sexual undercurrent to that as there is in the real world, but the idea of the older kind of antsy professor using the young woman to kind of be able to do exciting things in the world.
Sure, yeah.
I don't think that's an accident. And I think the way this episode actually emphasizes that in that middle section after she gets shot and we flash back, I saw a lot of chatter online about those scenes are both heartbreaking and sweet. They're very sweet. They're very heartbreaking. I also find them kind of disturbing in the way I think they're supposed to be, which is that, yes, the Doctor is really nice to Bill here, and Bill really, I think, values this man's friendship and respect he has for her. And I think he's kind of preying on that in ways that, like, again, I'm not saying the Doctor has become an awful guy or anything.
Yeah.
But I do think the episode wants you to draw some attention to he is in a really dark place. And I don't think we're going to really pull out of that before Capaldi regenerates. I think this is kind of the home stretch of his story, and it's interesting to me. And, I think they've pushed the Doctor into dark places before, obviously. I was rewatching some of the 10th Doctor episodes with the Master in them. I did the season 3 finale and stuff, or that whole three-parter at the end. And, one of the things I think that makes David Tennant's characterization of the Doctor so utterly compelling is I think he and Russell T. Davies kind of picked a direction which is manic depression.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm not saying that as a joke. He is a guy who has absolute mania, but also real depressive episodes. And he is someone who cannot hold a friend for more than 13 episodes. And he is constantly lonely, even when he is surrounded by people. And that story continues up to and including his final line, "I don't want to go." And I think that's a deep and interesting characterization of that character that is often predicated on him being in a really dark place. And I think with Capaldi, they've kind of done something similar in that he is always kind of an antsy doctor who wants to be the hero, but often winds up mired in some of the darkest Doctor Who stories. And I think this thing with Bill really drives that home. And I think you can't talk about all this without speculating, where does it go from here?
Right, yeah.
And like, what happens to Bill? Does she stay a Cyberman and stay dead? Stephen Moffat kind of laughed that off in an interview where he said, yeah, that's the last we've seen of her. She's just a Cyberman now. And I think he, there's a reason he can spoil that, yes, there will probably be more with Bill
in some way.
But, I think there's kind of two roads I can see with this, which is either she dies somehow in the next episode, very permanently, and there's nothing the Doctor could do to save her, which I think is a spiral I don't know if you can pull out of at a certain point. Or I think the Doctor's regeneration is going to be tied in some very specific way to getting Bill out of this mess.
Sure, that's a definite possibility. I think it is kind of hard to, because I think they could like it's hard to sort of imagine how you would go that far with sort of like psychologically and physically brutalizing a companion like they have with Bill, and like you said, not pull out of it in some way to lighten it up, especially with the Christmas special and stuff. This is not going to be like Peter Capaldi's regeneration episode. He's back for one more after the next one. So it's like,
unless they've hidden something really well.
That's not possible. It's 2017. You could not have done that. So there's no way that he fully regenerates. The other doctor shows up or something. Like they somehow have secretly cast and shot a scene with the 13th Doctor. I don't think that. I just can't see that happening.
They have to have cast the 13th Doctor by now. That's all
sure,
I'm saying. And that's,
sure, yeah.
They have kept that impressively under wraps.
Yeah.
I doubt that they've gone to the lengths of shooting a scene with him or her. But
Yeah. But so I think, I don't think that Bill is going to become normal again. But I think there's going to be a slightly more happy or hopeful resolution to her arc. But I think she's going to be dead. I don't think she's going to be alive. I think maybe he finds some way to give her a nicer, better death somehow than just living on as a Cyberman forever. But I'm going to hedge my bets with she is dead by the end of the next episode.
Let's go in a slightly different direction with that.
Okay.
Which is, if somehow she were to live.
Yeah.
We've said, man, Pearl Mackey is so good, I'd love to see more of her. Once I saw this episode and thematically where they're going with things, do you think there's a natural and organic way to have her zipping around with the Doctor having fun adventures next season?
Oh, no.
No.
No, absolutely not. It's definitely not going in that direction, even if she does live somehow. The one thinking about the Big Finish parallels and stuff, one thing that this has sort of reminded me of is the 8th Doctor. The new 8th Doctor Adventures, or whatever they called them, where the 8th Doctor has a couple of different sort of series he has done with Big Finish, and one of them was a pretty long one that they're very good with a companion named Lucy Miller, and she's a fantastic companion that is kind of like Bill in some ways because she's also very working class and comes from that kind of similar background, and she does not have a super happy resolution at the end of that storyline, and in some ways it is kind of like they're sort of similar stories, the end of the Lucy Miller arc and this stuff. And yeah, I don't know how. Obviously, last season they killed Clara and then brought her back at the end. But there's something really different about how Clara died and getting turned into a fucking Mondasian Cyberman.
Yes.
There's no. Her whole body has been cybernetically retransplanted and remodified in a very messy way. It's not you just put this person in a suit, which is how the new Doctor Who Cybermen worked with the David Tennant episode. It was kind of what it felt like. It's it's just kind of a shell or whatever that you put a person in. It's no, this is someone has been picked apart and had different pieces chopped off and replaced with mechanics until they are no longer recognizable as a human. That's what a Mondasian Cyberman is. And
yes.
So I just don't see a positive resolution to that. I don't see that character walking away from that, you know?
I totally understand. I mean, it is. I think thematically, our prediction is the same thing, which is that she's. Next week is Pearl Mackey's last episode.
Yeah.
I don't think you can go further than that. And I think whether she lives or dies, I think she has to be out of the Doctor's life. And I hope in some way that's her choice in some weird way. I hope some amount of agency is restored to her in that. Because I think she also has to be partially the one to realize this isn't healthy. In fact, this is a very different tone, but it is one of my favorite things in the Russell T. Davies years of Doctor Who, is the way Martha leaves the series.
Right.
Is at the end of her, because she has this whole thing throughout the season that I don't love, that she's carrying a flame for the Doctor and all that, but that she gets to own it at the end of her run and say, I did all these wonderful things, but ultimately it's not healthy for me to be around you, and she just gets up on her own two feet and walks out of the TARDIS. That's one of my favorite companion exits.
Yeah.
I think it actually cements that character to me as a more memorable companion than I think she might otherwise be. We're not going to have something that relatively normal happen with Bill.
No.
Obviously. I do think there's a chance she could live in some way. Again, I think there's a possibility. I do think whatever causes 12's regeneration is next week. And I think it's tied into all of this. And I think it could be tied into Bill. We'll see. But yeah, I'm curious to see where that all goes. But let's talk about Bill's scenes for a little bit. I mean, that middle stretch of the episode, which is so beautifully directed and cut and written, which is basically the actual action of an episode of Doctor Who, which is the Doctor doing the exposition and stuff, is like 3 minutes of film, and that's intercut with probably 20 minutes of the Doctor and the Master, who we don't know is the Master yet, down in the hospital, yeah. And we keep coming back and forth and seeing, like, okay, here's 10 seconds of Capaldi and friends, and now we're back to Bill.
Yeah.
How good was that?
It's really good. I mean, it's just the whole structure of the episode, like, even before you, because it's like you have all these different layers of narrative that like it transitions between, where before they kind of gets sort of embedded in that structure more, you have all the flashbacks that we kind of talked about a bit with the Doctor and Bill on like the rooftop and in the kitchen and stuff, sort of setting up the stakes of like and reestablishing some of the relationships so that when Bill is shot, you're like, okay, Jesus. And then she goes down, and then yeah, you have what is like a very sort of Moffat thing to do, to have like these parallel timelines that are running at the same time and sort of trying to transition between them and have them work together in different ways. You know, that goes all the way back to at least like the girl in the fireplace. And so like it's a very classic sort of Moffat trope, but I think it's pulled off so perfectly here in how one is, I think, the direction. It's like how those transitions are achieved and how like smooth that is. And I think how they, I think, really do ground, even though it's exaggerated extremely, they ground those two parallel timelines in something that is real, you know? Like that is true. Like, black holes, the gravity exerts a force on space-time, and that's like, space-time is both of those, it's space and time. It does not just distort space, it's not just you're getting sucked into the black hole, it's that the stronger gravity is, it's causing time to distort as well. So, theoretically, if you had this gigantic spaceship that like was that long and one end of it was very close to the black hole and one end of it was not as close to the black hole, the people at one end would be living in at time at a way that like if you were living at the close end of to the black hole, they would seem like their time is moving way fast and ours is very slow. That is true. And again, it would not work this way. Like if like one, this ship would be utterly destroyed. All these people would be streams of particles if they're that close to a black hole. But framing it in something that is real in science and like kind of like giving it that grounding makes it so much easier, I think, to sort of psychologically approach and intellectually approach what is going on in those transitions that allows you to sort of more smoothly move between them and have your like feet planted where you need them to be planted instead of like trying to figure out, well, what the fuck is going on? Why does it work that way? It's like some space magic. And it's like, no, it's black holes and gravity. Good. Cool. Yes. Like the fact that I was able to figure out what was going on with the time dilation before they start explaining it at all tells me that it's like, that is a good plot device.
Exactly. Because I totally was the same point where it's like, once they said, look, there's all these people down there. I don't know where they came from. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's what happened. And it takes a while for the Doctor to actually explain that. But it's okay because, again, it's such an organic plot point,
yeah,
that you're on board with it throughout the whole episode.
Yeah. So I think it's like maybe the best I've ever seen that technique done on Doctor Who of the parallel timeline thing. I just think it's...
Well, and the thing tying it into a character thing where there's this black and white TV that makes it look like a classic Doctor Who episode,
yeah,
where Bill is watching the Doctor move at, you know, nanoseconds of time, and she is just spending weeks and months,
basically at the pace of a classic Doctor Who episode.
Pretty much. She's just watching him slowly raise his eyebrow, and she's like, yeah, oh, this means he's explaining something, and that is like her one source of hope, and that TV is very much the lens. Every time we go back to the Doctor, we transition through that TV, and then we go back to the TV, and so it sets up actually like the cinematic grammar of that as strictly as it does the actual storytelling.
Yeah.
That's just a great melding of direction and editing and writing.
Yeah, it's just a really strong feat of cinematic storytelling because it's what you're asking the audience to be able to sort of like emotionally understand is really complicated and like is not normal. And it's a problem that science fiction runs into all the time. And especially when you are, you know, on an accelerated schedule and a smaller budget like a TV show, I think it's just like really amazing that they're able to do. It's kind of like also like Heaven Sent had a similar thing of like, this is a really complex concept that you're trying to sort of get across in an hour long episode. In that case, it's like the fact that you're able to do it so elegantly is just incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's... But then what happens in those scenes with, you know, the stuff with Doctor up there, some of the stuff with him and Missy and Nardol and the blue guy is all fun, is interesting.
Yeah.
But as you say, the meat of the episode is Bill and John Sim down there in the hospital.
Yeah.
And I just have to ask, When did you figure out it was John Sim?
I
was embarrassed by how long it took.
I think it was probably his second or third scene. I think.
Oh, really?
Like, it was at a certain point where I was like, there's something about it, and then like what it reminded me of was like I had this thought of like, wait, John Sim has to pop up in this episode at some point, and I was like, oh, that's him. This is so good that they brought this back, because that is something the Master always used to fucking do, is have these terrible fucking awful disguises. And so bringing that back as a character detail, it was like, good job.
And see, I haven't seen those classic Master stories.
It's very good.
I had the same feeling where, like, I know John Sim is in this episode. I didn't figure it out until pretty late in the game. And I think that is a credit to John Sim and the makeup team.
Yeah.
He tricks you. And I had watched the three, you know, season three Master episodes the night before. So, like, I had that guy's voice ringing around in my head. And the makeup is so good. It's all practical. It's him doing a voice. When he pulls off the mask, it's like he's actually pulling off the makeup. Oh, it's a phenomenal reveal. Like, I saw some people online, and I totally understand the complaint that, like, the previews spoiled too much and that it would have been cool not knowing he was in it. On the other hand, knowing John Sim had to be in there somewhere, when that happened, I shit my pants. Like, it's
so good.
Crazy.
When he rips the mask off and then, like, the slight, like, crash zoom they do on him on his face, it's like, oh, my God. It's very cheesy on one hand, but it's, like, so Doctor Who. It was so just, like...
And he's got the goatee!
He's got the goatee. Like, they've done a lot to, like, in some way to make it feel like, oh, like, yeah, he's, like... I mean, at this point, he's a classic Master or whatever. Like, his first appearance was fucking like 10 years ago on the show. So it's like, it's a long time in the past. And even though, like, I think, you know, the scripts for some of those episodes did not use that character that well, like, he was always good in them. So it's like, cool to see him, like, get to have this incredibly Master-esque entrance of ripping this fucking mask off, crash zoom in on the face. It's like, good job. Goatee and everything, it works.
And, you know, I should say, because again, I had not seen the John Sim Master episodes in this decade.
Right.
The last time I saw them was 2009, so I had not seen them in this decade. And I think I have let my memories of the couple of things I dislike in those episodes color it for me. He is really good in those episodes. Like, he is genuinely scary in some moments. I think he has phenomenal chemistry with David Tennant and kind of the way they... Because the whole thing of, like, the Master being his friend and kind of how they play with that, Russell T. Davies did the same thing with the character. And I think it's very interesting in those episodes. And you know, yeah, there is some really... goofy stuff in particularly part three of that three-parter, like CGI old David Tennant, which...
And him turning, like, Super Saiyan or whatever at the end of it to defeat him.
No, they beat the Master with the power of love, Sean.
Yeah.
Well,
not just the power of love, it's like the power of love basically turns the Doctor into a Super Saiyan. Like, it's incredibly absurd, even by Doctor Who standards.
No, it's really dumb. But throughout that, John Sim and David Tennant are really good. And so, like... You have him pull off the mask, and he, in that moment, though, is more confident in that role than I think he's ever been.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that to put down the old performances, just that he is so good in that scene and being like, you know, hello, Missy, I'm worried about our future.
Yeah.
And, like, just the way he plays, he's really only in one scene of this episode, and John Sim is in the whole thing.
Yeah.
But as the Master, he's in that one scene, and he fucking owns it. He's so good. And, yeah, I think I do wonder if they had... And there's no way they could have kept it secret that they shot two episodes with John Sim.
Yeah.
So I think they were probably wise to tease it the way they did, because better to own the story than not, because then at least the reveal didn't get spoiled.
And, like, more people are going to watch that episode because they know that John Sim's going to be in it. Like, that's, like, it's advertising 101. It does not give you, like, the surprises that some people want to have, but I think it's smarter from a business point of view to make that known.
And it's still a great scene.
Yeah.
It's a great scene.
It works on its own.
And he is very good throughout the episode as Crazy Disguise
Master. I think, like, Razor or whatever I think was his character's name in the credits.
Because that's the other thing, is I didn't know what to think of that character. And I think that the script does an effective job of that, where he is... on the surface, nice to Bill. And what you realize is, oh, this is like the most evil thing the Master has ever done.
Basically,
he's psychologically and physically tormenting the Doctor's companion for 10 years or something.
Yeah.
I mean, he commits himself to this plan.
It's the benefit of being a Time Lord. It's like, you can really fuck with someone. You've got this, like, length of time that to you is like, it's going to be a bit inconvenient, but I can pull it off okay. And for the other person, it's like, this is like a decade of my life.
And, you know, you were saying earlier, like, I said this is very much a part one, and you said, yes, but it really builds to something. And that's true. It's all set up But the setup builds to its own kind of miniature payoff, which is that the end of this episode is the unveiling of the Master's plan. And good God, it's an evil fucking plan, which was torture Bill for 10 years, torture the Doctor, turn her into a Mondasian Cyberman, and then team up with his future self. Oh, God. You know, like, this could literally not be worse for the Doctor and company. It is a... And it just... You leave that episode feeling kind of just punched in the gut.
Yeah. It's like, and one of the things I do wonder is how much of this did the Master plan ahead? Like, how much did he know, and how much was like, oh, okay, I guess this is what I'm doing today. Like, when, like, the Doctor and Bill, or like when Bill drops into his lap, it's like, well, this is what, okay, let's do this, I guess.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, one of the only avenues you could use to, like, predict that is like, oh, was he in cahoots with Missy somehow? But that scene makes it pretty clear she's as surprised to see him as the Doctor is.
Yeah.
And she does not remember this because of crossed time streams. And...
Sure. Or, I mean, it's been a long time from her point of view since this happened.
I guess so.
I will forgive her. I mean, she has been locked in isolation for, like, 1,000 years or something.
Yeah.
It's like, I will forgive her, like, a memory lapse on her part.
Yeah, so... It's interesting. I really want to see where this goes. I think there's so much interesting character stuff with the Master, Missy, and the Doctor to play with next week. I mean, that's the other thing. This episode, as good as it is, it bites off more than I would normally say an episode of Doctor Who could chew in part two. But I do have faith in this team at this point.
Yeah. One thing I'm really just curious about is what are they going to do with the Missy side of things? Like, how far are they going to commit to the, like, her like trying to like honestly rehabilitate herself? Like, how much is, like, will she just end up teaming up with the John Sim Master, or is that going to be like the conclusion of that story, is basically the Master fighting him / herself? Like, that I'm really interested in, because I think you could do either direction and have it work. I do hope that it is like Missy is legitimately trying to rehabilitate herself, and that, like, she cannot stand her past incarnation, because I think most Time Lords would not like to hang her out with, like, their 1,000-year-old younger self. That's just, like, if I had, like, my 14-year-old self here, I wouldn't be very uncomfortable with that and, like, very disappointed and angry at that person. So it's, like, I think that would be an interesting direction to go in, is have her, pretend to team up with him but really kind of work against him in some ways. Or be, like, torn between the two sides.
Well, let's talk about Michelle Gomez's scenes in this episode.
Yeah.
Because, as usual, she's fantastic.
Yeah.
And this episode is mostly not funny, but the beginning is very funny.
Yeah.
With her coming out and pretending to be Doctor Who, and then going on a very Moffat-esque piece of writing that somehow works, which is that do you want to hear his real name? It's Doctor Who. I mean, okay, we spent a lot of time complaining about the Doctor Who jokes a few years ago. Why does this work better?
Because it's not just a throwaway dumb gag that doesn't need to be there. It's like, it's a legitimate, like, extended humor sequence that I think, like, one, like, it's just the jokes land harder. I think partially because Michelle Gomez is very good at delivering the jokes.
I didn't know she was a stand-up comedian. I saw some of her on YouTube. She's funny.
Yeah, she's very funny. And so that works better than, and, like, it just was in the season 7 stuff, or, like, in, like, because it was, like, the end of season 6 is where you get the decapitated headman going, Doctor Who! Doctor Who! It's just like, what the fuck? Dorian is his name. And then season 7, it was just like you had 2 or 3 of those jokes every single episode, but they were all meaningless. Like, you could have cut out all of those and it would have been the exact same scene. Like, this, the whole opening is predicated on being self-referential and, like borderline just fourth wall breaking at points, where it's like Missy is just sort of deconstructing the, like, format of Doctor Who on the show in a way that I think works really well for that character, because it makes sense. Like, she's old enough and smart enough, and has, like, if you, like, you know, count, like, the Master's time on the show, that character has been around long enough to be able to, like, I think do that believably for me, of, like, just being able to pick apart, like, yeah, like, this is, like, the function that these people serve and stuff like that. Also, like, straight up, guess what? Doctor Who's name? It's Doctor fucking Who.
Yep.
Like, I have at least 3, I think, compelling pieces of evidence for why that character's name would be Doctor Who. One, for the vast majority of the history of the show, the character has been credited as Doctor Who in the credits.
variably as DR dot or just doctor.
Yeah. So like that's the for the like it's a relatively rare thing for like the doctor the credits. So that was like David Tennant era and stuff. They did that.
They did it through Eccleston, and then David Tennant specifically requested it, and it stayed the doctor ever since.
Yeah. So it was like it's been on and off here and there, but it for the majority of the history of the show, he's been credited as Doctor Who. The third Doctor story that introduces the Silurians is called Doctor Who and the Silurians. It maybe is the only Doctor Who episode that has that title format and is like one of the weirder oversights, I think, in the history of the show that some producer didn't see that and say, that's not how we title episodes on this show. Like, that was the beginning of the third Doctor era. The show had been around for almost a decade at that point. It's not like it was a new thing that we don't do Doctor Who and the monster or whatever. But they did Doctor Who and the Silurian, so clearly the character must be named Doctor Who if they do it that way. And then the most critical, massive, fucking, like, incontrovertible piece of evidence in the history of the show that the character, the Doctor, his real name is just Doctor Who, is that in the first Doctor serial, The War Machines, which precedes The Tenth Planet, which is the first one that has a Mondasian Cyberman in it, so it's like of a piece in some ways with this episode stylistically. In The War Machines, the supercomputer Wotan that knows everything is an omniscient supercomputer that knows all knowledge in the universe effectively. I don't know how it knows that, but that's like the setup of that episode. Multiple times refers to the character specifically as Doctor Who. He says the lines, capture Doctor Who, in the episodes. So the characters, he is Doctor Who. I've watched every episode of the show, and I can say with some confidence that has always been the answer to that question.
I do like Stephen Moffat on his way out the door cheekily canonizing that.
Yeah.
Just like, And that scene is so great because it's basically Peter Capaldi and Michelle Gomez playing verbal tennis.
Yeah.
And it's something I almost wish we had more of, which is just these two incredibly talented and funny actors just playing tit for tat on this verbal humor. Yeah. It's so great. I mean, you get to hear Peter Capaldi say the words, I'm Doctor Who, or something like that. It's great. And yeah, Michelle Gomez is very good. But the other underlying thing of that scene is that's not her just being a dick. That's playful ribbing between friends.
Yeah.
And I think the whole thing there, like, yes, she has some darkness where she says, you know, like, these are my disposables and things like that, which are funny jokes. Although also, given what happens to Bill in this episode, not an unfair critique of the Doctor.
Exactly.
Like, she's not acting like evil Missy. I think she is acting like someone who's always going to have an edge to her, because how would you not?
Yeah.
But like, you know, someone who I think is at least somewhat committed to doing this and seeing it out. And like, she is throughout the episode. Like, here's one thing, is this episode was kind of pitched in the preview as, oh, Missy leads a Doctor Who adventure. That's ultimately not what the episode is. But she is on the team through the episode, and she keeps doing things to try to help out and, like, be an active participant in the team. She is also worried when Bill gets shot and things like that. I just feel like it would be a cop-out if the next episode is she's like, well, my old evil buddy who was also me came back, and I'm going to be evil now. I can see there being a temptation, and I think that's going to be the crux of the next episode, is her being pulled between these two figures. And I do like that Moffat realized, okay, I have this internal crisis for the Master, or our version Missy. What do I do to, like, literalize that internal crisis? Oh, we can bring back John Sim, and he can be the evil Master, because he's really good at that. And Michelle Gomez can be the conflicted Master, and then we'll have Peter Capaldi on the other side. And I think that's going to be a really interesting push and pull next week. I do think it'll ultimately come down to Missy siding with the Doctor, because that's just good storytelling. Like, it's more predictable, but frankly, I really do, unless it's done very well, feel like it would be a cop-out if it went the other way around.
Yeah,
so,
me too. Yeah, but I'm very excited to see how that's going to land. It is a lot to set up for the next episode, but it's a very tantalizing setup for sure.
And then we have to talk about the teaser.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, this episode just straight up opens with the Doctor crawling out of the TARDIS on an ice planet and not just regenerating, but going, no!
Yes, resisting the regeneration.
Two thoughts on this.
Okay.
One, in a vacuum, I like it.
Sure, yeah.
Two, why the fuck did they let the Lie of the Land have a fake regeneration in it? Because
that really
cheapens that scene. Like, I thought it was cheap in The Lie of the Land, and if you're Stephen Moffat and you know the kickoff to your final episodes of Doctor Who for both you and Peter Capaldi is going to be you are teasing his regeneration, I don't think this is, like, fake. Like, maybe it'll get pushed back from that moment, but I don't think this is another, like, oh, just kidding, you know, why would you do the cheap fake-out thing in episode 8 or whatever that was?
Right.
That just feels very cheap to me in retrospect.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I didn't really, like, think about it in the moment because, like, that scene is so nothing in that episode by the end. That's just, like,
yeah.
I had actually forgotten that they had done that. But you're right. Like, it was just stupid in that episode.
Yeah.
It is, like, it doubly is stupid knowing that this is how they were going to open this episode.
All right. But we put that on the table. Yeah. We talked about it. How do you feel about doing an in media res teasing of this is where the 12th Doctor is? I mean, he's got longer hair.
Yeah.
This is clearly at some point in the future. We don't know how far. This could be somewhere next week. This could be the Christmas special. We don't know exactly where they're teasing. I do think it being at the beginning of part one of a two-parter means we will get back around to that in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Even though, again, I don't think they somehow pulled a coup and Capaldi is gone next week and we're going to meet 13. That'd be really weird.
Yeah.
But
unless the 13th Doctor is just Bill. There you go.
Or it's been Nardole the whole time.
Who knows? Yeah, like, I think it's just, it's a good cold open for an episode of just, like, what the fuck? Like, but it sets up the tone of, like, oh, this is going to get bad. Like, yeah. This is going to get desperate at some point.
Well, and I do like teasing, like, even, I mean, we know this is at least one of the 12th Doctor's final stories.
Yeah.
I think very clearly saying, this is it, it's coming, and even if he's trying to resist it, he can't. It's coming. I think that does add a weight to everything we see here, that whatever mistakes, choices, triumphs the Doctor has in this story, it's going to end in him dying. And that's interesting.
Yeah.
And it does, you have to speculate with it, right?
Yeah.
My guess is that we're going to get back to that scene at the very end of next week, and that will be our cliffhanger into the Christmas special.
Sure, that's a possibility.
I think he'll find some way to delay it. I don't think that is actually going to be Capaldi's last moment as the 12th Doctor.
No.
Because usually they get to make a speech.
Yeah.
And it would be sad if he didn't get to make a speech. Even the 7th Doctor, when he walked out of the TARDIS and got shot by, you know, thugs, got to say a couple of things to the thugs.
That's true. I mean, he got to say some things when he woke up on the operating table because anesthesia doesn't work on a Time Lord the same way.
Yeah, something like that. So, yeah, but, I do think it's going to straddle the two. I don't think, like, we're not going to get back to it next week. That would be
weird. We're definitely getting back to it next week. Yeah. Like, that would be crazy if they didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
I have no idea what they're going to do with it. Like, there's...
But next week is, the title of the episode is The Doctor Falls, which normally I'd say might sound a little hyperbolic if it weren't, you know, kind of the end of a really long era of the show.
Yeah.
Spanning two Doctors, one head writer, and now, you know, this great 12th Doctor, and... Yeah, I think he is going to fall in one way or another next week.
He's already fallen in one way or another in this episode, so yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think it's interesting. We're probably being set up for a finale where the Doctor doesn't just win the way he normally does, you know? And I think Stephen Moffat has enjoyed playing with those kind of fearic victories before.
Yeah.
You know, I think season 8 has, you know, okay, they beat the Cybermen, they beat Missy, but then it ends with the Doctor and Clara are both so kind of emotionally devastated they lie to each other instead of repairing their friendship.
Yeah.
Season 9, very complex conclusion, even though I think it's ultimately very uplifting in how it goes about things. I'm very curious to see where he goes with this.
It could be anything. Who knows?
Because it really does feel like next week is going to be the climax, the denouement of the Capaldi years.
Yeah.
And Christmas will be some kind of coda.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm really curious to see what they do with it.
Me too.
What else is there to talk about with this? Oh, I have one thing.
Okay, yeah.
The best scene in this episode from a directorial standpoint is when Bill is, like, in her hospital room and she starts hearing pain, 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 and she's exploring the hospital and finds just that incredibly creepy room of all the in-progress Cybermen with just, like, the white, you know, gloves over their heads, and realizes there's basically this, like, volume knob on their heads.
Yeah.
That is legitimately maybe the scariest moment or extended sequence Modern Who has ever pulled off.
Yeah.
And Rachel Talalay's direction in that and other scenes, like, I have, just from the modern Doctor Who standpoint, I think the Cybermen have been pretty lame villains.
Oh, yeah.
In modern Doctor Who stories.
I agree.
They were scary here.
Yeah. I mean, because for me, that is the last big thing to talk about with the episode is, like, the Cybermen in general and how they are used here. And it is everything I was hoping for from bringing back the Mondasian Cybermen and, like, what it means for them to be Mondasian Cybermen as opposed to other Cybermen. So now is the moment I get to give my big talk, my speech on Mondasian Cybermen, where the Cybermen went wrong, and why finally we're fucking going back. Like, we're writing a mistake that was made in, like, the mid-70s or whatever, whenever that, like, the first fourth Doctor Cyberman story where it's, like, it really ruined it. Because I don't think there were any third Doctor ones. They took a break for a long time. But, so to go back, Mondasian Cybermen, the 10th Planet, which is the original Cyberman story, and is, like, the only proper appearance of the Mondasian Cybermen. That is, like, the reference point they use for the design for this episode. Like, the Cybermen are more similar in the Second Doctor era than, like, what they became. But it's, like, they really go back to, like, 100% basics.
I mean, how great is it? These are not, like, CGI Cybermen. No. This is, like, the same costume they used with William Hartnell.
Yeah, it is, like, very similar. They look slightly higher budget, but it's, like, it's basically the same design. It's the same basic concept. Even, like, the voice they do is very similar. We don't have as long sentences, so I can't 100% determine if the speaking style is exactly the same, but it's very close so far. We'll find out next episode if they 100% nail that part. But for me, the 10th Planet Cybermen, the original Cybermen, are the most interesting version of those monsters by far, because what the Cybermen turned into, and, like, especially in modern Doctor Who, they turned into robots. Like, they're just robots that happen to have used, like, a person inside of them at one point, but that human part of them is not identifiable at all. They're just robots. They're not men. They're not Cybermen. They're just robots that call themselves Cybermen and whatever. And that's why they're just fucking boring. Because everything... You know, there's billions of robots in the history of Doctor Who that are evil robots.
Modern Who has done more to humanize the Daleks than it has the Cybermen.
Absolutely. Like, you know, like, we got in, like, the first Dalek episode for New Who with Dalek, you see the mutant inside of the machine, which is, like, something they had never really done on Classic Who. If, like, they were sort of implied to be there, but they never showed it. And so, like, that... They really humanize... It's like, is it like humanized? Maybe not the right word, but like they biologize the Daleks. They make them a physical organic entity that, like, you are aware of the fact that it is a physical creature that is inside of a machine. Where the Cybermen, it never, like, really achieves that effect. They try it in the Age of Steel two-part or whatever with the 10th Doctor, where they reintroduce them from, like, a parallel universe and all that shit. But I feel like they never sell the concept of these are, like, that, like, the people are in there somewhere. It's like, no, as soon as they go into the machine, as soon as they go into, like, the suit, they're dead, and it's just a robot. Like, that's always what it felt like to me. Do you agree with that assessment, Jonathan? Someone who is more familiar with that and not familiar with the old Cybermen.
I think there are some Cybermen stories I like as stories, like Nightmare in Silver, Closing Time, and I think the closest they've come to, like, doing that humanization you're talking about is probably the Dark Water, Death in Heaven two-parter with Capaldi, where it's the dead people in there. But even then, that episode is really problematic for a number of reasons. So, and they're still not scary.
Yeah, and they in there, they only sell it for, like, Danny as a Cyberman. They don't sell it for any of the other people. Because I think it's a problem with the design. And it goes back to, like, at least the fourth Doctor era, and even more, like, some of the redesigns they did in the second Doctor era, where... It's, like, just this big silver thing with, like, this full big headpiece and full mask that completely obscures the face. And then when it's the modern Doctor Who stuff, like, it's an utterly robotic thing. At least in, like, classic Doctor Who, because they didn't have a fucking budget, it was, like, they were wearing, like, silver jumpsuits. So, like, it was, like, very clear that it was a person in there in classic Doctor Who, so that kind of worked. But in the modern stuff, it's, like, the human figure inside, like, the actual literal human actor inside of the suit on the set is so utterly obscured by everything that it never sells the idea that that is a person. They just look like a robot. What made the original Cybermen work is that it was not like that at all. Like, the original pitch of the Cybermen is, and this is something that maybe they will recap. I don't know how deep they're going to go into the Mondasian stuff next week, but they got more into it in this episode than I thought they were going to, which is Mondas is, like, a mirror world for Earth. It's a literal twin planet, which is not a thing that is real, but whatever. It was, like, 1966 or something. And by mirror world of Earth, I mean literally Mondas is, like, the exact same planet, but, like, it's flipped upside down. So it's, like, which doesn't make sense because it's in space. It doesn't make sense because it's in space. But it's, like, if you, like, how they showed it was, like, it's like a globe, but if you flip the globe upside down, the only reason the globe is the right way up or whatever is because we were in the Northern Hemisphere and you know, the people living in the Northern Hemisphere.
That is such an
Hemisphere invented the globe first.
That is the most British thing I've ever heard.
It's very good. It's very good. It's a nice piece of history. So it's the twin planet Mondas. It got sent, like, in this orbit really far away from the sun. The planet, or basically by being so far away from the sun, all the life on the planet was slowly dying out. And so to save themselves, the Mondasian humans, which are just humans, they're not humans upside down, which doesn't make sense. They should be upside down humans, but they're just human humans, basically. They, to survive, they slowly start replacing pieces of themselves with machinery and robotics in order to survive the harsh new climate of their planet. And the reason why it has that premise is that the writer, Kit Pedler, and like the team that sort of took over in that the very end of the first Doctor era and then sort of segued into and introduced the second Doctor era were interested in getting into like more speculative fiction kind of stories instead of the kind of more fantastical stuff that, and the historical stuff of the first Doctor era. And so the basic premise and like idea of the 10th Planet was to explore in this era where like... you know, prosthetics and stuff are starting to become more of a thing because, again, this was like 1965, 1966. That's becoming more common. And it was kind of like saying, like, well, what happens? Like, right now, that's awesome. Like, it's amazing technology. Like, it's incredible that if you've lost a limb, like, you can replace that in some way with these, like, primitive prosthetics they were inventing. That's really amazing. But if you project really far in the future, like, what is, like, the dark, like, conclusion that that could come to if we're not careful with it? And that was the Cybermen, that you slowly start, like, it's not just someone who's injured, who's lost, like, a limb, and you replace your arm with a prosthetic limb. It's, like, it's more than that. It's, like, you're, and it's not just, like, a pacemaker on your heart. It's more than that. Like, you're taking away whole large chunks of the human creature and replacing it with robotics until eventually, like, one of the last conclusions they make is that in order to, like, be able to psychologically withstand being a Cyberman, which is something kind of touched on again in this episode, you have to remove part of like what it means to be human. You have to remove some of your emotions. You have to remove some of your pain because like if you have all of that, you wouldn't really be able to sort of like get psychologically withstand. Like you couldn't see yourself in a mirror and be sane anymore if you were so fully replaced with robotics and you wouldn't know who you were anymore. And so that was the basic setup. And it's like this really dark premise that they don't fully go into all the ramifications of that, obviously, in the 10th Planet. But the setup is really strong. The concept is really strong. And I think the really shitty special effects of the day worked so much to the advantage of that design because you could tell it was a fucking person. You could see that, like, you could see the, like, point A and you could see point B. And you could see how, like, it was hard to tell where, like, you stopped being a human and started being a Cyberman.
And that's what makes this episode brilliant, is it lives between point A and B, where you only see one Mondasian Cyberman in this episode, and it's Bill, which is really dark.
Yeah.
But throughout the episode, you're seeing them in different phases of completion, and if you've ever seen a Mondasian Cyberman, like, from even if you haven't seen the episode of The 10th Planet, you might have seen a still or something, you know that they are becoming that.
Yeah.
Right? And think of how much they're able to achieve by, like, basically putting a sock over the actor's face and having them have just little pieces of machinery all over.
Yeah.
It's legitimately scary. I mean, Modern Who, I can think of like two other episodes that I think are legitimately scary in moments, and that's probably Blink and Midnight.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's no coincidence, those are also lo-fi episodes of Doctor Who.
Yeah. Yeah, like how you sell the body horror of the Cybermen and how like you make them a unique creature that is not just a robot is you make them eerily organic. It's about the uncanny as a concept. It's about them being in this weird middle space because it's like the trick is I think it's all in the face. It's all that like the face of a Mondasian Cyberman is basically a dude with like pantyhose pulled over his head with like the mouth and eye holes cut out and like eyeshadow or something behind that so that it's like utterly black behind the mouth and the eyes and then you have a little headpiece on and that's it. But like you can tell there's, like, a human face moving underneath that. You know that, like, if you ripped that thing off, there'd be some fucked up, scarred, weird-looking human visage, like Darth Vader style, behind that. And the fact that it's, like, it's always there on the edge of your vision, like, you can, like, kind of see it, but not 100% make it out, that's what makes the Cybermen work. It's also, I think, in the way they talk, I fucking love the way the Mondasian Cybermen talk in the 10th Planet. And that's the only time they ever talked like this. And you kind of get a sense of it here, but they don't do it all the way. Because how they did it in the 10th Planet was so good that you have the actor playing the Cybermen just opens their mouth like all the way wide, like basically like you're at a dentist and go like, ah, and they just open it like, ah. And then someone off screen or whatever, or they was probably someone off screen. They did not dub it in.
I was going to say.
They definitely did not dub it in. So someone off screen with like a decent sort of like, you know, vocoder thing that like kind of changes the quality of voice delivers the lines and the actor just sort of stands there like still with their mouth just open, and the other person sort of delivers the line. And it's such a good effect. And they don't, again, there's not a lot of them talking in this. It's like you don't kind of fully get the sense of if that is exactly the direction they're going in. But there's this good, like, middle line of, like, they still need to open their mouth to, like, create a chamber for which the sound to escape. But it's like they don't need to move their lips or tongues because they probably don't even have fucking lips and tongues anymore. So it's like it's some sort of speaker somewhere in their chest. It's creating the sound. But you have to create enough of, like, a channel for it to exit to be able to, like, communicate clearly. And that middle space is so good. And again, it's driven by invention from lack of budget and resources. If you come up with how do you get these things to talk. Also, the way they talk is very good. And it's basically, because you just don't have the long sentences, so it's hard to get the sense of it. But it's like, I don't know how intentional this was, of like the thought of why they talk like this, but it always sounded to me like it was like the human brain is able to come up with like these sentences and what they want to say very quickly, but whatever like robotic piece that is actually like translating that into sound can't quite keep up with it. So it's like the words stack up and then you have like these long like droning syllables. So it's like, we are the Cybermen. And it's like this really good like staccato kind of speaking style. It's like, we come from the planet of Mondas. And it's like, it's very specific and very good. And you, again, you only get kind of like groans and one or two sentence like for, like, or one or two word phrases from Bill in this episode as Mondas and Cybermen. So I hope we get more complete sentences so you get to like to have that full effect, because it's just, it's so brilliantly done. It's one of my favorite sort of creatures in classic science fiction, like bar none, like outside of just it being Doctor Who, because I think they just found such a good way to make the resources they had at the time sort of motivate them and make them be creative in how you express this creature in a way that once the show got more resources, over time the Cybermen became less and less interesting because they became a lot better at making them robotic, which is what they were supposed to be, but because they couldn't do that originally, they were way better. So yeah. I'm really glad and excited that they have like captured that energy and that idea, because this episode, like you said, it's all about being in that weird uncanny middle space. It's all about like the transition and this like fuzzy transition between like how organic are you, how robotic are you, you know, like where does it happen with Bill, because like for much of the episode Bill has this huge chest piece over her that you don't really get to see all of, but like you know that she's been partly replaced with machinery, and then at some point it's just is more and more and more until you have her walk out and you don't know it's her yet. Like it's really well done, and it captures that like organic body horror vibe perfectly, I think.
Yeah. So next week the finale, we have lots of hopes for it, I think.
Yeah.
I just hope it's good. I expect it will be.
I think it's going to be good. Like, it's been a long time since we had, like, a part one episode that was such a strong setup. That's like a very, like you said, like, part one. Yeah. That's part one episode in some ways.
Heaven Sent is an episode.
Yeah.
It continues, but it's not a part one.
Yeah.
You know.
This is more like the season 8 finale, but, like, done well. It's also more like the season 8 finale in that... Also in that finale, like, the one significant black character on the show gets turned into a Cyberman. I don't know what that says. That's probably just a total coincidence. But I thought it was kind of weird that, like, twice in the Peter Capaldi era, you've had, like, a significant black character. And both times they have been specifically turned into Cybermen, which is a hell of a fucking coincidence.
It is. I mean, the thing is, like, Danny as written... could have been, like, any ethnicity, yeah. So I assume that was, like, they cast him just because he's a really good actor. Bill, maybe it's more specific, I don't know. I almost think maybe they cast Pearl Mackey before they wrote the character, just because she is so perfect for that part. But yeah, it's, you know, this show, there are weird trends with the black actors on this show. Like, in the RTD years, the two black actors of significance, Martha and Mickey, randomly are married in the finale.
Yeah, it's like they've never met each other. There's absolutely no reason other than, I guess, they're black. I don't know. Is that the one reason, RTD?
Yeah. I like both those characters, so whatever. We will find out. I'm excited. Twin Peaks is not on next week, which is sad, but...
Maybe almost for the best.
It gives us time to talk about this, and it'll deserve its own episode, So which is what we usually do for a Doctor Who finale. So, you know, and I would not be surprised if... Once the finale airs, and like by the time we get to when we record this, we might get a 13th Doctor announcement.
Yeah.
It has to. They're shooting it. They're shooting the Christmas special. It has to be coming. So I assume we're going to find out sooner rather than later. Not that I want to think about what happens after Capaldi, but we're going to have to learn eventually. So We will see. That's Doctor Who. You want to move on to Twin Peaks?
Can we even move on to Twin Peaks?
So, Sean, last week, Twin Peaks, part 7.
Yeah.
We got, I think what a lot of people agreed was, like, a surprisingly narratively coherent episode of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, it was bizarrely straightforward in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, things moved forward a lot in that episode, and I think, you know, you had a lot of people who had maybe been on the fence about this season even, kind of being like, yeah, that's more what I was looking for. And we were like, you know, and we were not on the fence. We loved all of it, and loved that too, but we were like, yeah, that was kind of cool to see more plot stuff. Spoilers from here on out.
Spoilers for God of Light.
Yeah. Of course, David Lynch followed that with the single most avant-garde thing to ever air on American television.
Yeah. And probably by like a significant margin, I would imagine.
No, there is a stretch of this episode that is a straight-up avant-garde short film.
Yeah.
Like, no ifs, ands, or buts. It is nothing but... like, it is Stan Brakhage, Maya Darren, Kenneth Anger, and so many other people just thrown in a fucking blender. And the fact that most people watching Twin Peaks have never heard of those filmmakers is what makes it wonderful.
Yeah, it is definitely... it is... I feel like this is the episode where, like, you are either all in or it's time to go home.
Yeah.
It's like you have to make the choice because it's like, you know, I do not blame people for watching this episode and utterly bouncing off of it. I think that is a totally understandable reaction. But holy fucking shit, was this episode amazing.
I want this episode turned into a drug and injected into my veins.
Okay,
I love
that's
it.
That's just asking for someone to murder you.
I know, but it would be a good death.
It would be a hell of a death.
Oh my god.
It would be a very interesting way to go.
Yeah, no, this is my favorite episode of the revival so far. Like, episode 3 is definitely up there, but this was just a great film.
Yeah.
And it happened to air on Showtime at 7 p.m. on a Sunday.
It happened to be episode 8 of Twin Peaks.
Yeah. And you know the best thing?
Yeah.
This is only episode 8.
I had that exact thought.
There is no guarantee this is the weirdest it gets.
I mean, that is like when we were like 20 minutes in or something, or fucking 20 years in, however you, whatever weird dimension we entered, however time passed, and the giant was slowly walking up the stairs in like the fucking set of Frankenstein or wherever they were. I had this thought of like, oh, this is episode 8. We're not even halfway through yet. We're almost halfway through. Jonathan, what the fuck is the last episode of Twin Peaks The Return going to be? How is this going to end? What is episode 18 if this is episode fucking 8?
I am more sure this week in my prediction that the way this ends is Good Coop and Bad Coop are going to go off a waterfall together. The thing is, that waterfall doesn't necessarily have to be on Earth. It doesn't necessarily have to be a waterfall. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in the present day.
And also, Good Coop and Evil Coop don't necessarily have to be human figures anymore. They might be just abstract, like, five-dimensional cubes at that point.
Yes. Oh my god, this was amazing.
Yeah. What a fucking episode.
I really, let's slow down for a second.
Uh-huh.
This aired on American TV.
Yeah.
Even on cable, is Showtime, all that. Showtime is still a major cable network in the United States.
Yes, like they funded and produced this thing.
This doesn't happen. This will never happen again. This is, unless there's more later in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
This is one of the most incredible, you love it or hate it, they funded David Lynch to make a fucking hour-long avant-garde short.
Yeah.
And he made it, and he aired it, and it was beautiful and glorious, and I loved it so much I watched it twice, primarily because the first time I watched it, I like watched it right as it came out at 7, and there was some sun coming in from outside, and it made it hard to see the TV, because this episode is either all like really dark or inky black and white, and so I loved it, but I wasn't going to turn it off and wait, but like I did the next night, once the sun had gone down, I turned off all the lights and watched it just in the pitch dark, and I think the photography in this episode fucking believable.
Yeah, because I watched it. I basically started watching it like right at the stroke of midnight when it came out, because it was like I had a lot of stuff I was doing that evening, and then it was like, oh shit, Twin Peaks came out, because I hadn't even looked at Twitter or anything. I had no idea what the reaction was because the episode had aired a couple of hours earlier, and so I was like, oh well, do I have time? And then I had this thought of like, you know what, the best and most like dangerous moment to watch a David Lynch thing is like right when, like, as soon as I finish this, I'm going to have to go to sleep, like, immediately. Like, I can't, like, push this off anymore. So it's like, as soon as I'm done, this is like an hour, it's going to be like 1 in the morning, I have to go to bed. It's like, that is how I watched Mulholland Drive for the first time. That might have been basically the state I was in when I watched Eraserhead for the first time. It's been a long time since I watched it, but I think that probably would have been like early in the morning or very late at night. And that's like, you're in this interesting psychological state at that moment. And I think that David Lynch like preys upon, and it was fucking amazing.
Oh man, I loved it. This episode like solidified for me also, like, you will never be able to do a critical appraisal of the work of David Lynch without the return of Twin Peaks.
Oh, absolutely.
From this point on, like, there is a way you could read this show so far as like his magnum opus, because a lot of people made this comparison, and I thought of it too the moment it started. This is David Lynch's creation sequence from The Tree of Life, which, if you haven't seen, that's the Terrence Malick movie, The Tree of Life, where about 25 minutes into the movie, he cuts away from the little middle American family and shows the creation of the universe on down to life on Earth. And it's an amazing, beautiful, operatic sequence of effects. It's very weird. I would not necessarily call that like a full-on avant-garde sequence, in part because it's pretty clear how it's connected to the themes of the film. I don't think you can say it's necessarily clear how all this is connected to Twin Peaks, although I think it is very, very much.
Oh, yes.
And this is that. This is David Lynch taking a break from the story to give kind of an impressionistic, non-narrative piece of filmmaking that I do think is the skeleton key to unlocking everything else in the work.
Sure.
And I think not just of Twin Peaks, I think that there are two basic big avant-garde sequences. There's once Evil Coop wakes up and then suddenly it cuts to the nuclear blast. There is that too when we skip ahead to 1956. That's one. And then all the stuff in 1956, which is more narrative. It's like a little short story, but they're both very weird.
Yes.
Those two things together, that I think you could cut into that from almost any of Lynch's works, because it is so much commenting on all the things I think are fetishes and ideas for him in his works about the darkness at the heart of American life, basically. And we have so many things to break apart with that. But yeah, it is like his creation sequence, and I don't know where I was going with this. But no, what I was saying is like that's how this feels like. He did not come back and do Twin Peaks work for hire. He made them do Twin Peaks for him.
Exactly, you know?
And, like, he had something to fucking say here. And here's how personal this is. Like, I saw this wonderful documentary last week. It's going to come out on the Criterion Collection later this year, called David Lynch, The Art Life. I think you can rent it on iTunes now, and I highly recommend it. It's a great little documentary. And it's mostly actually about David Lynch and his paintings, which, if you don't know, Lynch considers himself a painter, first and foremost. He's done that all his life. And when people say, oh, he hasn't done anything since Inland Empire, that's kind of insulting, because he spent that entire time painting and doing exhibitions and stuff like that. And so the whole documentary, you see a lot of him doing paintings, you see a lot of his paintings, and I love David Lynch's paintings. In some ways, they're like very amateurish in the way he shows like human figures and stuff. But in another way, one, their sense of composition is absolutely stunning. And really, I think there's a clear line between his composition and his paintings and his sense of cinematography. The other thing is they have this sense of like instinct to them, that they are made by pure, like, he goes into some kind of weird art coma and like makes this beautiful, weird, monstrous design, and then comes out of it, and I don't think he could tell you exactly what he was doing.
Right.
This episode of Twin Peaks, especially the middle segment, but even a lot of the stuff at the end in New Mexico, looks more like a David Lynch painting than anything else he's ever done. And it is kind of an interesting thing that he has made hundreds of paintings, and most of his films do not look like his paintings. Eraserhead very much does. Parts of, little things in Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire. But not until you get to this episode of Twin Peaks. Like, there is that one shot of, it's during the big nuclear blast sequence, where that ghoul, like, comes out and is flying.
Creature thing.
Yeah, and then it, like, vomits out this long strain. That's every David Lynch painting. That's what they look like. Like, that is so much one of his paintings brought to cinematic life, and so much of this episode is like that. So, like, I think there's also something artistically personal where he is doing the same kind of thing in this episode he does when he paints, just on this big visual effects canvas, which, again, this was not cheap. Showtime shelled out for this, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so those are some of my opening thoughts. I mean, what else would you say before we dive into some of the nitty-gritty here?
It's hard to almost like... I mean, I really agree with you that there is a sense of this, of it is like kind of the most uncompromising, intense examination of the themes that he's most interested in, which is like the dark underbelly of America that is always sitting there, that like we have like this nice sheen on the surface and it's always resting there, which I think is one of like the main reasons why so much of his stuff feels like it somehow is taking place in the 50s, even though it almost certainly, like, either literally isn't or it probably isn't. Like Blue Velvet could maybe be, but it also like doesn't seem like it actually is. It just wants it to be set in the 50s, which I think is part of like what the, like what he's getting at is, it's like that's that period of American history where I think we still have this insane cultural memory of the 1950s being this like perfect era in American history. Like somehow there's this like pop culture image of the 1950s being Leave It to Beaver and like 1950s black and white sitcoms that with like nuclear family, 2.5 kids, like, you know, heterosexual, nuclear family, obviously, and like white picket fence and like perfect school. There's no poverty. Race isn't a thing because you only see white people. And if they're like black people, they're very nice black people that wash your car. You know, it's like, but you don't, but like nobody ever like, it's not that nobody ever critically engages with that. It's that like the larger cultural memory of that is so resistant to the criticism of that era, which is like, that is also the era of fucking McCarthyism. That is like the era right before the civil rights movement. So it's like, you know, it wasn't fucking good if you weren't white and straight and middle class in that era. And it's like, it's an era of a lot of really fucked up shit that was happening in America, but that pop culture image of it is so resilient that even today, I feel like you have that impression of it somehow, of it being like this idyllic pastoral image of America somehow.
David Lynch's American pastorals, if you want to call them that, his dark pastorals, are about us. They're not about him.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm very resistant to in some Lynch scholarship I see, which is, and I already saw this over the weekend with people talking about this episode, which was like, I saw one critique of like, oh, should we be concerned? Like, it's always why are the hobos and the homeless always evil in David Lynch's thing? Why does he think that about the hobos and the homeless? And it's like, he doesn't think that.
Yeah.
That's not the point of that scene, to me at least, and I understand.
Because they're not actual homeless people, they are these like imagos of homeless people that are supposed to frighten you.
The key scene to all that is, it's near the beginning of the New Mexico sequence where you have that elderly white couple driving down the road, and they're so scared by this homeless people, and what that plays as is like that old woman sitting in her chair having a nightmare about it, right? Like, that's the thing, they are coming out of their fears, not the other way around, not like, I need evil here, what should the evil be? It's, in this setting, what is the evil in this idol that we have here? In
like, what is it that these people are afraid of? That it's like, and it's the, it is homelessness, it's like, it is the horrors of, like, the nuclear bomb.
It's dirtiness.
It's the things that, like, are, that all these people are benefiting from, and that their lives are literally, like, in some cases, literally built upon. Or, like, you know, there's a lot of, like, references to, you know, Native Americans in Twin Peaks. There's obviously, and then you have Hawk actually there. But then, and also in this, you have, like, all, like, you know, little, like, the Nez Perce stuff and stuff like that. And that's another, like, you know, one of the great tragedies in, like, crimes in the history of America is what we did to the Native Americans, which is what we did was fucking killed almost all of them. So it's pretty fucked up. And it's like, it's this world, this very comfortable world that these people live in that is built on this tremendous history of suffering and wrongdoing and evil, effectively. And nobody wants to look at it, because of course nobody wants to look at it. And so that's why it is like this homeless man walking up to you and going, "God, a light." Because that is something that, like, and I feel like anybody who's, it's like anyone who's like at least like middle class, if not like even lower class or in America, like you have that fear of like someone that you don't know who this is, and they're frightening and they're intimidating, and they come up to you and like they interact with you. Like I was on the light train, the light rail station to go down to Denver the other day, and there was a guy like a couple of seats in front of me who was like very aggressively talking to another guy sitting there. They obviously didn't know each other, and like it was this kind of tense situation, and it was something where it's like you don't know what this person's sort of deal is, like what they're trying to do, what they're trying to get out of this. And there's, I think there's a really intense fear about that, about interacting with this other person that is homeless or poor or something, and you don't want to look at them, you don't want to interact with them, because you're like viscerally afraid of them and you're viscerally ashamed of yourself for that. And I think that's like one of the core things he's playing on in this episode.
I mean, it's funny because you've already seen, you know, parts of the internet, I think, kind of turn themselves in knots of, like, what exactly does this mean to Twin Peaks? And, like, where does Bob and Laura and all this stuff fit into it? And to me, it's like, they're symbols in a larger picture being painted here. To me, though, there is a broad picture where you can get so much out of this. It's not, oh my God, I don't understand what I saw. I understand, in broad strokes, I think a lot of what I was supposed to get out of that. And that's because it's good avant-garde filmmaking.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what you're supposed to get out of that is it's no mistake that that long sequence of the episode starts with a push-in on the first nuclear blast in the United States.
Oh, yeah. That's, you know, that's like the key to all of it.
Yeah. It's about the release of evil. Not that this was the origin point of all evil, but that this is a... There's literally this nuclear blast at the heart of that American 50s idol.
Yeah.
And it continues to today. Yeah. You know, because that brought us to 1956, but the lines between everything we're seeing there and Twin Peaks 2017 are pretty clear, you know, thematically, and so much of New Twin Peaks is about drawing lines between the past and the present and the darkness that exists on both sides of that equation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can totally see you want to do some of the symbology of, like, that was the birth of blah, 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 and I actually think, I haven't seen a prediction yet that actually, like, mathematically adds up with anything we saw, so I'm not really interested in them. Like, no... That was not Laura Palmer at the end of the episode.
No. Yeah,
Unless there's time travel involved, that makes no sense.
Yeah. Like, I think there are definitely, like, I think there are a couple of pretty, like, distinct, clear symbols near the end of the episode. But we'll talk about that. Let's start going through the nitty-gritty of it.
Yeah. I mean,
there's so much to unpack here that we need to, I think, go in order. Because it's like, if we just jump around, we'll be here for 5 hours.
And I'll have to just, at some point, read excerpts from my notes. Because me trying to... I had one point where... Basically, that whole middle sequence of the nuclear blast to the end of the 1945 stuff, I had one paragraph that stretched across 3 pages because I didn't know where to put in the break, and I had to later go through and put in breaks for myself.
I mean, I imagine that is basically what the script looked like, if there was a script for this at all.
Who knows? It's great. But no, I mean, it's actually easy to forget that this episode does have about 15 minutes of... relative Twin Peaks normalcy.
I mean, I think that's the kind of the genius of it, is that the beginning of this episode is like this, I mean, it's very well done, but is at its core like this very cliche crime movie kind of scene between these two characters in the car, and there's this tension, and it's like, oh, like they're trying to kind of like betray each other, and it's like you've seen this in like every fucking mob movie ever made. You know, this is like a fucking Goodfellas ass scene.
Yeah.
That then eventually descends into utter insanity, but I think like it... starting with something where you have your like grounding and reminded of how where like this is going to fit juxtaposed in like the grander tapestry of this season of TV is really smart. And like instead of starting with just like the explosion, I think it's one of the things that makes this work as a narrative in a way that like maybe like a lot of avant-garde movies don't, but like not necessarily that they're not even necessarily always interested in being that like narratively direct, but this is able to, by having that framing, I think it sets it up to be more easily sort of digested into the larger narrative.
This works as its own piece of art. This hour of television is a very powerful, unified work of art. So yeah, you start with a very direct continuation of last week, where we've got Dart Coop and his buddy, Ray. I got his name this time. Because Kyle MacLachlan says it very terrifyingly. Yeah. And they're driving down the road, and there's a weird thing where... I think what happened after 2 viewings is Coop has an app on his phone where he could transfer the trackers from the car they're in to another car on the road.
Sure.
Is that right?
I think that makes sense. I think it's just another instance of like technology being gobbledygook on purpose.
Yes.
Because they're not... It's not... Because what? Like because it's... Whatever it is, it's fucking bullshit. It's him being smart.
I think Dart Coop has some kind of weird magical power over technology.
Yeah, I mean, we literally saw him typing utter nonsense into a fucking search engine and somehow getting out the results he wanted, even though they weren't what he typed in.
And making a telephone make the strobe lights go
exactly,
off.
Exactly, yeah.
So anyway, he does that. They have this whole little conversation about Daria, which includes the great line, "You'd probably like to go to that place we call the farm. Farm." And we find out that the information Cooper wants from Ray is that Ray has memorized all... the numbers, and I love the idea that all the numbers we've been hearing on Twin Peaks so far are part of a grand piece of information that Ray, or that Dart Coop needs for whatever his machinations are.
I maintain the numbers are going to be utterly meaningless.
They are, but that's what's funny about it. Clearly David Lynch and Mark Frost have seen Lost. That's all I got to say about that. Anyway, and then they drive down this dark road, and I love the POV shots here.
Yeah, it's a callback to how Dark Coop was introduced in episode one or whatever, of like the shot from the car. In this one, it's in the car. Originally, it was just from like the hood of the car.
Yeah,
going through like this dark like road at night with the headlights.
Oh,
it's so good.
I could have watched an hour of that.
Yeah,
it's very dark. And yes, on certain TVs and streams, it would be hard to see. And I heard that complaint. The filmmaking is the filmmaking.
Yeah.
I'm so excited for these episodes to be on Blu-ray because Showtime's streams are actually very good as streams go.
Yeah.
But there's still, like, the image is so complex in this episode that you still get some macro blocking and stuff.
Yeah.
And I would love to see that, like, in pristine Blu-ray quality. But yeah, anyway, I love those dark. They also remind me of the beginning of Mulholland Drive and things like that. And you say, they drive down that road, and then finally they pull over because Ray has to take a leak, and Coop has the gun that we know the warden put in there, and he checks the bullets, and then he goes and he says, You're going to lose $500,000, Ray.
Yeah.
He's about to shoot him, and it doesn't work. And then Ray just caps Dark Coop because, of course, he does.
Yeah. And it's another thing of, like, it's one of the things I just love about how David Lynch handles all, like, the weird crime movie stuff he does in these, is how, like, it all makes sense because it's like working on cliches we're all familiar with, but like he doesn't bother to fill in any of the details. This scene was in the script was made out of Mad Libs or something, but it like totally functions, which is almost like maybe a weird commentary on genre or something at some point. But it's like the technology is utterly meaningless. Like he just does a thing on his phone and it's like, aha, I have outsmarted the warden. It's basically the information you're supposed to get from that. He's like, oh, how smart he is. Nobody can ever beat him at this stuff. And then he says like, you know, he's just like, oh, go to the farm and like, I need the numbers. And it's like, the farm is not a place that means anything to us. It's just like this ominous phrase, but it's utterly meaningless. It doesn't tell you anything. It's the same thing with like the numbers is like the thing they're getting for. It's like the briefcase from Pulp Fiction or something. But what is like, fucking gives a shit what the numbers are. And also it's like, how did Ray do anything to that pistol that was in the fucking glove compartment? Like, we know, other than if like something or how in between the episodes they took a pit stop and Dark Coop was away from the car, there's no moment in time between Dark Coop getting Ray out of jail, them both walking together, getting into the car at the same fucking time, and driving together, that he would have ever been able to mess with the fucking gun in the fucking glove compartment.
21st century David Lynch loves his genre exercises.
Yeah.
And like, Mulholland Drive is all that. It's a series of genre exercises, and they're wonderful, just deconstructions. Inland Empire does that to a certain extent, but it's not a coherent movie, so you know, it's harder to say. But then Twin Peaks, this Twin Peaks is very much, I think, in that Mulholland Drive mold, and especially all the Dark Coop stuff so far, it's been leaning harder and harder into that.
Yeah, it's like all the dog leg shit last episode. It's so perfectly done. It's so good.
And then the weird stuff happens.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
but it starts like acceptably weird. It starts weird in a way that you're like, this could have happened in old Twin Peaks. Like, it's not mildly insane.
Minus the graphic violence.
Sure, It is able to be on Showtime, but other than that,
You know, I mean, you have the blue strobe light, which is how they always did Bob in the old show.
Yeah.
And you have, like, the superimposed bodies of basically what look like the homeless people from later, and who we've seen before in these these eight episodes. We're seeing them more and more, as I think we predicted last week. They're going to become a big thing, and boy, did they become a big thing this week.
Yeah, I just didn't expect them to become a big thing that quickly.
I know. But they're going around, they're doing some weird ritual with Coop. Even in the best lighting, you can't quite tell what's going on. They are, like, dancing around him, and then they're, like, stabbing him, and they're smearing his blood around and all this stuff.
The thing it reminded me the most of, it, this is, like, something, I think this episode is like playing off of like cinematic references so heavily throughout, like constantly, and this like reminded me very much of what is like one of the most famous shots and sequences from Night of the Living Dead, which is the original zombie movie where the zombies are, it's like, I don't think they're not even eating like a character, you know, there, or maybe it might be after the car explodes and it's like one of the people die and then they're just like eating this person on the ground, and like there's like, you know, this sausage link or whatever that's supposed to be intestines, and it's like this very iconic sequence and shot from that movie that this is very similar to, that without them like literally eating him, but how they're like pawing at the body on the ground is so much like how it is in Night of the Living Dead. I think it's very much on purpose.
Yeah, it's a horrifying sequence.
Yeah.
And Ray is horrified, as he should be. And he gets in the car and runs away.
It's the beginning of like the brilliant sound design in this episode as well, where it's like Ray's screams are like drowned out in this weird way. It's very good.
Oh, the sound design is off the fucking
charts. There's also the shot of, like, I think it's supposed to be Bob's face, like Frank Silva's face, basically, like, rising out of, like, the corpse of Evil Coop, and, like, but in, like, this weird womb almost or something. Like, it's a very bizarre shot, but it's good.
It's fascinating, and, like, I did not know that was Bob the first time I watched this, because it was obscured by, like, light refractions on my TV.
Yeah, after I went back on the stream and, like, rewatched that sequence and freeze-framed it just to check, it very much looks like it's supposed to be his face.
But it's funny because I didn't know he was in that scene at all, so the second time I watched the episode, I, like, had an audible, like, jump scare when I saw him. Because
It's really unsettling because he's basically staring, I think, into the camera. It's, like, very creepy.
Yeah, God. Again, if you read all the stuff, apparently Frank Silva was, like, the nicest guy.
Yeah.
But, boy, he looked creepy.
Yeah, he looked creepy when he needed to look creepy.
Yeah. I mean, he's a good actor.
Yeah.
Although he was a carpenter on set or something.
Yeah, he was not an actor by trade, but he fucking made it work.
Oh, he's great. But, yeah, so that's a creepy scene.
Yeah.
And then we get Ray in the car apparently talking to Philip Jeffries.
Yeah,
right, I assume that's the Philip he's talking to.
It could be anybody who knows.
Who knows? And let me
see if it's ever going to matter.
He says, you know, he thinks Coop is dead, but he's not sure. And he says something about how what he saw might be the key to figuring all this out. So that's cryptic.
Yeah.
What are they going to do? Like, Philip Jeffries is clearly a character in this somewhere in the background. I know they wrote it for David Bowie before he passed.
Yeah.
I wonder what they're going to do with that when we get there.
Yeah, it's hard to tell, like, how, if they ever want him to be, like, have, like, a more active presence in the show. Even if, like, you're not going to have the actor there, obviously, like, have the character do, like, commit some sort of action or something. Or if it's just supposed to be
nebulous,
this sort of, like, cipher or something in the background that you're never really supposed to be 100% sure of.
You know, if they have to have him there, I would not be offended if they recast Philip Jeffries.
Yeah, me neither.
No disrespect to David Bowie. He's only in, like, 5 minutes of Firewalk with Me. If they have to do it, they have to do it. You could get a fun David Bowie impersonator. I don't know.
I mean, the fact that, like, what the nature of that character in Firewalk with Me is so nebulous that you could very easily justify recasting him if you need to.
Yeah, so we'll see what they do with that. But it is interesting. I mean, Ray was terrified by that, but the most interesting part of his reaction is it wasn't unexpected. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't like, what the hell was that? He was like, this might be the key to everything.
Yeah, it feels like somehow, like, in that scene, it just gives you the sense of that, like, the information that is conveyed to him psychologically or whatever by what he sees. Like, I feel like he almost, like, maybe sees something a little bit different than, like, what we can see in it because of, like, the crazy dream state or whatever of, like, who knows what the fuck that is. Because another, like, thing is, like, to talk about with how that scene is shot is, like, it's not just that you see, like, these like, figures of, like, the homeless people clawing at the body. It's that, like, in all the shots, they're, like, silhouettes are, like, superimposed on the image, like, dancing around. So it's, like, they have this, like, weird sort of all-consuming presence in the frame at all times in that sequence. And so it's, like, there's something more going on than just, like, the weirdness of the zombie kind of element of it. It's feels utterly supernatural, like utterly otherworldly.
Yeah. And then we have a cut I love, which is from the dark, shadowy smoke and fog and everything of that Coop murder ritual thing to the strobe lights and darkness of the roadhouse.
Yes, where, quote unquote, the Nine Inch Nails
are performing. For some reason, they went out to the boonies in Washington and are performing at this little dive bar. But, you know, it's whoever is the promoter at the Roadhouse is really good at their job.
You know, I think it does give this sense of, I feel like every time we see more and more of Twin Peaks, though, there is this impression that that town has grown a lot since the last time we saw it. In a way that, like, I think it's, like, intentional that, like, some of the bands that show up at the Roadhouse are much more recognizable. To, like, obviously, like, Nine Inch Nails is, like, very recognizable and very famous. But so maybe it's not 100% believable that this bar would be able to get them, but I think it does give you this impression of, this is not the same town we used to know. Like, this is not the town where it's, like, there's, like, this one, like, kind of hot jazz singer lady that probably lives, like, the next town over and does a gig here every other week or something. This is kind of the impression you got in the old show. This is, like, it is an attractive small town that people want to go to for reasons.
Even the Double R Diner, when we've seen it, has been way more busy.
Yeah, it's packed with people all the time.
It's like it's a tourist attraction.
Yeah, it's just a much busier, much larger town at this point in the show, I think.
You can almost imagine maybe it's like, and we're getting a little off topic, but I think it's interesting, like, the actual town where they filmed Twin Peaks has become a significant tourist site
because
of the show. I wonder if that informs how Lynch and Frost wrote this.
Maybe, yeah.
And I could see that because, you know, they a lot of their process, I think, is going to Washington and taking in the atmosphere and building off of that. So, yeah, anyway. But the Nine Inch Nails play, and I find this sequence fascinating because it's kind of the most indulgent of the music performances so far.
It like, feels like it's basically the whole song. It's like you it watch is, a full music video.
You do. I mean, I listened to the song. It's on. It's their new EP is what it's off, and it's on Apple Music. So I downloaded it and listened to it. It's a great song.
Yeah,
but it's like a 6-minute song, and it's the whole thing in Twin Peaks. And we have had songs before in the show, but they're usually like for the credits or there's something else going on. This is just kind of in the middle, well, not in the middle, but near the beginning of the episode, and there's no other characters we know. It's just the Nine Inch Nails performing, and both, especially the second time for whatever reason, I found it kind of riveting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because it is so atmospherically perfect with what's going on in the episode. Like, I doubt, as written, they were like, and then the Nine Inch Nails performed.
And then, quote-unquote, the Nine Inch Nails. It's very specific in the credits. Yep. There are quotes on the.
Yes, the Nine Inch Nails. No, I don't think that was in the script or anything. I think it's probably, this was one of the many performances they captured there intending to use it, and then said, hey, this goes perfect in episode 8 as like this little palate cleanser, but a very dark palate, like a palate darkener, before we get into the weird shit.
I think there's also a thing to look at of that every other time there has been like this more extended musical performance in the show, it has been over the credits.
Yeah.
And this is like, it's like it is the bumper. It's like this thing is like it ends the normal episode of Twin Peaks, is like concludes with this musical performance, and then like the insanity of what we're going to get is like about to begin. And so it's like, yeah, it's a palate cleanser. It is this like moment where it's like it just gets you, I think, in the mood in a really good way. And it's just like it's like you're watching a really well shot concert film,
basically. Oh, I want David Lynch to go shoot Nine Inch Nails concerts now. Yeah. It's unbelievably shot.
Yeah.
It's so good. And I mean, here's the biggest thing. Trent Reznor's music is so perfect for David Lynch.
Uh-huh.
And it's like if Lynch had been actively making films in the 21st century when I think, you know, Trent Reznor started doing movie music and stuff, he would have done a score for a Lynch movie.
Yeah.
Like if Angelo Badalamenti were not alive and kicking and doing the score for Twin Peaks, he might have hired Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. So like that song could not be a more perfect fit for the mood of Lynchian Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And yeah, listen, I would recommend that whole EP. I listened to it today while I was working on the podcast project I mentioned. It's like 22 minutes. It's great. And it really is like, I almost hope they shot songs from, like, they shot the whole EP, and those are DVD
extras. Well, had them there. It's just like, just do the whole thing, and we'll figure out what we want to do in editing, and just put it in the DVD.
It's, because it's really cool, and it is, again, like, it's such a perfect fit for Lynch's visual style. So, yeah, I think it's actually one of the master strokes of this episode is having that there. Because you don't need to know anything about the Nine Inch Nails. I'm not a huge fan of the group. I like Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross and their movie compositions and stuff, but, like, it just works perfectly. Yeah. And then we do have one more shot with this stuff, which is there's a moon, and then we come down, and Evil Coop sits up, and then we hard cut.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. When you mentioned earlier that we see Bob kind of come out like a womb, it made me think, we don't have any reason necessarily to think that's still Evil Coop in there.
That's an interesting point. Maybe Dougie Jones got repackaged and redistributed on Earth as you know, mulleted Cooper.
We just, I think probably the safe assumption narratively is that this is showing that Evil Coop for now is kind of immortal.
Yeah.
And that makes him even
scarier.
That's
the impression I got from it. But.
Yeah, but like, he sits up, he's fairly blank-faced. We don't know who that is.
Yeah.
Because body transference has been a major theme so far.
That is true.
Especially when the forces of the Red Room and the Lynchian Netherverse are involved. But from there, we cut to a really wide panoramic shot of the New Mexican desert.
Yes.
And it says 1945. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Or no, it says July 6th, 16th, 1945, White Sands, New Mexico, 5:29 a.m.
Yes, it gives the exact like clock, and it's like seconds ticking down.
Yeah.
And then
the bomb goes off.
And this is Trinity. It is like the first nuclear bomb test that happened. So like it is that moment. It's like it is like this is something where we transition to for me. Like a lot of this section, the rest of the episode has these like biblical overtones in a way that like is kind of not I feel like normal, like a normal thing for Lynch. I feel like he doesn't go for biblical references or something like that. But this is like, I think a lot of the symbolism he works in here has like these Genesis and like Book of Revelations, like Armageddon, apocalypse kind of overtones to them.
Hence,
that are very heavy.
Hence the easy comparison to Terrence Malick and the Tree of Life,
exactly,
which is also biblical, but in a less apocalyptic sense.
Yeah.
That's the Book of Genesis. This is Revelations, you can almost say. Yeah.
It's the beginning of the end is the moment the bomb goes off, because that's like this moment of like, it's like the world is changed, because it's like that is the moment where humanity has acquired this weapon that we can like literally cause ourselves to go extinct. Like we have in that moment proved we have that capacity. It's like,
and that shot,
yeah, the world is different now.
That shot, however it was created, however it was filmed, I have no idea how they did it. It's one of the coolest shots I've ever seen.
It's amazing.
Film.
Yeah,
I mean, it's because we like the camera acquires godlike powers in that scene because it's from this giant panorama into the heart of the cloud, and that push in is breathtaking.
Yeah,
it's. I really would love to see this episode on, like, IMAX.
Uh-huh.
Because that scene, like, I forgot I'm watching it on a 40-inch TV. It just envelops your whole field of vision because it's doing something a camera should not be able to do. And it goes straight into the heart of that cloud. And, you know, we should say here, from this point to the end of the episode, the music is the star of the show in a lot of ways. Because it just is, the soundtrack is so amazing. This, it screeches and dissonant tones and, like, probably razors on violins and things, but it is outstanding and amazing. Yeah, so we go into the heart of the cloud, and then it becomes other kinds of exploding smokes, this very avant-garde footage, flickering film stock, like broken images, these like white specks dancing across a black screen. Very, very Stan Brakhage-esque, if you've ever seen any of his work. I reference Brakhage a lot because he taught at CU Film School, which is where I went, and you know we have a lot of his prints and stuff there. But there's definitely, there's so much Brakhage in some of that stuff. There's because he did this stuff where you know he would like you know play on actual you know film leaders and like you know paint on them or scratch them or things like that. And there's a lot of that here with some of the flickering and just there's other people you can reference too, but that's where my mind went. And this is where, once we started getting those, like, dissonant shots that aren't even representational of anything, that's where I was like, oh, we're doing this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it is, like, this long sort of visual montage of, like you said, a lot of this stuff. Like, once you enter into the bomb. And, like, I also have to say, like, that shot, like, going back to other movie references, I think there's a lot of smaller things, like, we'll get to it later, that is referencing that era of science fiction movies of that where it's like a part of one of which for us obviously like a big one is Godzilla, but like there's also like the whole tradition of American science fiction movies of like them and stuff like that of having monsters and creatures created by this nuclear explosion and what are the effects of this. Also, obviously, like, you know, comic book movies are a huge fucking thing. That's like the origin of like every other fucking like 1960s comic book superhero is like Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, whatever, or the Hulk. It's all about like the fear of radiation, the effects of radiation. I feel like there's like a lot of allusion to that. And if they ever decide to make a sequel to Shin Godzilla or something like that, they should just fucking take this shot and just use this shot that at like the heart, at like the center when it's going through, if like the reveal of that is fucking Godzilla at the center of there, that's like just to, like, can someone just make that for me, please? Just like do that. Just like take, here's what I will tell you exactly what you need to do. Take the very end, the last like 15 to 20 seconds of Godzilla versus Destoroyah, take that, those images of Godzilla in the smoke, and just find some way to edit them into the camera moving into the smoke in this episode of Twin Peaks, and I will die a happy man. Because it's like, it's so perfect. And I think it like so puts you in that mind frame of like this, the era of like nuclear fear.
Yeah. What's interesting, so in this montage, we also get, most of this stuff is in black and white, or like sometimes very stark blacks and whites, like just hard blacks, hard whites. And but then also during this montage, we get eventually this exploding fire and colors. It looks like the birth of the cosmos. This is where I think you make those Malick connections and stuff. And it's just like, yeah, it is. This is like a dark creation sequence. There is fire and hell and unconventional images and things you cannot make sense of at the heart of this cloud.
Yeah.
If you even take it that literally, that this is what's happening inside of that.
Yeah, that it definitely, like you said, it looked like, it looked like how you would film like the early universe that is this very dense ball of gas, and there's like just these explosions in the background of stars being born and exploding and supernovas. Like it's just like always out of your vision, like deep nestled in here. That's like the, it is this like weird creation imagery, but that is kind of made very sinister by what is doing the creating. Because also, like, that is the nature of nuclear bomb. Like, that is the kind of power and energy you are tapping into. It's nuclear fission, not nuclear fusion. But, like, it is the energy of, like, the creation of the universe. It is, like, the energy produced by those things. And so, like, that, it's very, I think, savvy to use that imagery.
Oh, absolutely. Eventually, we get back to, like, some of that black and white smoke footage. But then it fades into this little picture montage of this convenience store.
Yeah.
We're back to black and white. Almost everything through the rest of the episode is in black and white. And there's lights flickering on and off inside. There's smoke coming in and out of the store. But it's all done like stop motion. Like it's a series of stills that are kind of quickly edited together. You have smoke and lights and they're looped and repeated. You have this crazy dissonant music. And then you have all the people in there and it's all moving around in different weird patterns. And the music is kind of tied to it. And it's a technique that sounds like something that I've seen in a lot of avant-garde films where you basically, you have, I forget her name. It's a modern avant-garde filmmaker. It does this wonderful animation, but she does something with, where, like, she actually, the soundtrack is just, because with the way on Film Leader, the soundtrack comes is that the sound is on the sides of the film strip. And so, if you just leave that sound blank and, like, extend the printing of the film into the sides, then your sound will be whatever is actually on the leader, like your images. And there is, I'm sad I'm forgetting this filmmaker's name, but she does all these, they're like the blanket series or something anyway, and she does that where she just lets the sound be whatever is coming from the images, and so you get these dissonant, like, harsh tones coming through, like, you know, and it does that throughout that sequence with all the people moving around and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know what technique they used to create that. This is all digital, obviously, so you wouldn't do it exactly that way, but it's that kind of sound technique where it's like the sound of the physical image, which is a really interesting idea in this kind of filmmaking of, like, what is the sound of texture?
Right.
And we're getting that there.
It also, like, reminded me of, partially because, you know, like, watching it over a stream, there's, like, this brief moment where, like, if the, like, lead up to this had not been as insane as it was, like, and there was this brief moment where you would think, like, oh, did my stream break? Because it's, like, the way that the image sort of, like, skips and stops and juds, it feels like the way that, like, if you're watching a stream and it's, like, not quite catching up, and then, like, maybe, like, you know, sometimes there's, like, you know, if you're watching a stream and it gets weird, like, for a brief second, like, two images will be kind of superimposed on one another for a little bit and stuff like that. I feel like it's using some of those kind of distortion techniques that you're familiar with in, like, digital video and streaming video. It kind of plays with that while also, like, doing a lot of other techniques, like the weird shit they do with the focus going in and out and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that convenience store image is interesting because we get back to convenience store stuff later, but that's like right in the middle of this long, you know, middle sequence of the episode. And I think it's interesting that we have this whole creation sequence, then we have something weird being born in the convenience store.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, here's one of our American pastoral images of, like, the 50s convenience store, and there's a darkness being born in the heart of it. Again, I think these connections are very instinctual and powerful.
Yeah, and it was one of the most, I think, unsettling moments for me in the episode was when it goes from this empty convenience store to there just being people there all of a sudden, even though you're never really able to make out the figures or anything. It's just like, it like really put me on edge because I didn't know, like, what these figures were, like, what they were going to do. And then another thing, just the image of the convenience store, particularly when it was empty, reminded me of is, like, some of the most frequently used stock footage of nuclear bomb, like, tests is, like, the image of basically a mock convenience store looking kind of building getting destroyed by the shockwave of it. And you've seen it in fucking 100 million movies and TV shows. It's used all the time, and it, like, very much looked like that kind of shot, and I kept on expecting it to be destroyed, and then it's not. Like, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. No. Okay. I'm going to read from my notes for this next paragraph because it's the best way I have to describe what happens
okay,
next.
Okay, go ahead.
And then we'll talk about it. And then a ghostly pale gray figure floating in total darkness, puking out a long stream of viscous fluid, all black and white. Looks like the figure from the box in the first episode. In a bubble is a face. Is that Frank Silva? And then we seem to be at the atomic level, which explodes into more fiery color footage. A gold bubble emerges from this chaos and swallows the screen. Suddenly we're rushing as if through space, but it's all red. Red dots flying by us at light speed. The dissonant strings wail. And that fades into a purple ocean, the waves rocking back and forth as the camera flies over them. Right. The horizon is far and infinite, but eventually an island appears, the waves crashing on its rocky shores.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much... There's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, like this was sort of like after the like dude that looks like the Fluke Man from the X-Files appears and spews his goop or whatever that I assume is like the birth of Bob. Because I think there's also an image of an egg in there too.
Okay.
Because that's where the egg comes back later. I might be wrong about that because there's a lot of visual information you're trying to process. And it's not entirely clear. But then after that, it has, like you said, like that sequence of where it kind of looks like the stars and then it turns red and then it's like zooming really fast. And that's where it starts... I feel like it feels a lot like the end of 2001 A Space Odyssey in some of those sequences to me.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Kubrick is actually one of the few connections I didn't make myself while watching it, mm-hmm. but I understand why people reference that because, you know, now we are going to another dimension, basically.
Yeah.
Because what is on that island on the purple water is this big tower of, like, rough stone, and then we pan up, and then there's this sleek, modern, smooth stone tower. It's enormous. And we pan in and in again, another godlike shot through this little slit, and then we're in this, like, black and white, old-timey, Lynchian, wavy weirdness room where there's a woman dressed to the nines. She's got jewelry. She's sitting on a couch, swaying just slightly to the music from a gramophone. And basically, it's just clearly the area from the beginning of episode one where Cooper gets sent out by the giant.
It also is a lot like parts of the sequence of episode three.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because now we're clearly like, I love what you said when we talked about episode three, that the Red Room is the bottom of everything.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's so clear that, like, the Red Room is part of, like, a multiverse of dark dimensions where there are beings beyond our capacity to understand in any way.
Yeah.
And I love that Lynch is going full bore showing us that to the point where now you think about, like, the Red Room scene in episode three of original Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Nothing. There's nothing weird about that at all.
No, it's just people, like, walking backwards and speaking backwards and, like, talking in non-sequitur phases. That's, like, the most natural shit in the world. Like, I could do that in my sleep.
What I love also, though, about when we get in here, we have, so there's this really well-dressed woman, and we have the giant appears.
Yeah.
I have seen people take shots out of this and, like, show them on Twitter. Every shot in this sequence looks like a painting.
Yeah,
and not a David Lynch painting, but, like, a 19th, 18th century... Again, like a pastoral painting. I think of like the, what's that painting with like the husband and wife and
the
pitchfork?
I can't remember what the name of it is, but
everyone
knows what that painting is. Yes.
Yeah, it reminds me of that, like the kind of this very stoic but really beautiful like sense of composition. And even like the way the shots play with depth and light, it doesn't look like live action photography. It looks like an oil painting.
Yeah.
And all of that is fascinating. I want to know how he did it, you know?
Yeah, it's the thing of like, you know, we talked a little bit, I think it was probably an episode about a month ago, when you watched the black and white version of Logan, and we talked about a little bit, like, about black and white photography, and that's, like, something where if you are someone who has never, like, really watched a lot of black and white movies and don't get, like, why people would maybe, like black and white movies and think they look fucking awesome, and you're like, it's just, like, what a color is awesome, why would you not have color movies, like, if you can do color, just do color, like, this is what you sit someone down and show them, is like, look at this motherfucker, like, look at this fucking shit, it's so beautiful, it's so utterly gorgeous, and it reminds me of, like, it made me think of Frankenstein and like kind of like German Expressionism. We talked a little bit about that on the last week Twin Peaks thing. It had that kind of quality of it, like the very deep shadows, and it's really rich image all the time.
The blacks are so deep it looks like you could swim in them. I mean, the word I keep coming back to is inky, because like my TV doesn't even necessarily do all that great with blacks, and yet I was watching and I'm just in awe of like how much depth and texture there is to every part of the image, and it's those things that only black and white can really draw out. God, it's breathtaking. But yeah, we have this whole long sequence where there's this giant, like, bell on the ground, and it's ringing, and it's like a 5-minute scene of the giant. He walks up.
He's been in the frame the entire time. He's just been obscured by the alarm thing.
Yes.
And so he steps out from behind it, and I love that. That's a really great moment.
Yep. And he's in his tux. He looks perplexed. He comes up and, like, looks at something like we don't see, and then he goes and examines the ringing bell. He hits a button and turns it off. Then we have that kind of Frankenstein or Dracula is one I thought of too, like the Universal Dracula, where he's going up those ornate carpeted steps, And then I love that shot. Like, it actually lingers after he leaves the frame for a couple seconds, mm-hmm. and it's just this great emptiness. And then we're in this big room, and it's wide, and it's vast, and it's dark. There's another bell in the middle, but he walks past all that towards the front of, a movie theater.
Yeah.
And I love this because that movie theater he's in looks so much like the Mayan in Denver. Have you ever been to the Mayan?
Yes, yeah.
It looks like the front of the Mayan, like where where the exit is, where the screen is, what the stage looks like, and the Mayan is one of the oldest theaters in the country. It's one of the old-timey movie theaters where people might have watched, like, The Wizard of Oz back in the day.
Right.
And so he's got that. A lot of people compared this to, like, Méliès stuff, where George Méliès, one of the early filmmakers, and how he would play with theatrical settings. It's very much like that. And then what we've been watching starts getting projected on the screen in order. Yeah. We don't see all of it, although I wouldn't put it past Lynch to have a cut of this where he just replayed everything up to the moment where the giant pauses on that shot of Bob.
Yeah.
So now we're very much, we see, like, our attention is drawn to Bob because the giant is looking at it, and then he starts to levitate.
Yeah.
And then the woman walks in. And I'm not even operating off notes anymore because this is seared into my memory.
Yeah.
The woman walks in and there's a stage light, like a circular stage light, trained on her at all times. And she kind of walks up to him. And while she's walking, the giant has become like, he looks like a vampire in a coffin, but without the coffin, levitating in the air. And now we start playing with color because this like gold dust starts coming out of his head and extending. And the music here is like achingly beautiful.
Yeah.
And she is clearly, like, overcome by this. And out of that comes this glowing gold orb, and it comes down to the woman, and she holds it and looks in it, and we see Laura Palmer's face.
Yes.
And she gives it, like, this little kiss and throws it, and then we go up to the ceiling, and there's all this golden, like, there's cogs and gears, and there's this long instrument, and the golden ball goes into that instrument. And now the screen is showing an image of the planet Earth.
Yes,
and
but it looks like kind of almost like the RKO logo or something from back then. Like, it's this very sort of like primitive image of the Earth because obviously it's like not actual space photography or anything like that.
Right. And the golden ball goes into the image and it starts heading for Middle America. That's like the one concrete thing you can tell is it's heading for Middle America. Maybe even further it could get onto Seattle or something where Twin Peaks is. But yeah, let's break that down.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, that's just a stunning sequence.
Yeah, it's just, like, it's one of those things where, like, even if you're not interested in, like, trying to dissect, like, what it's doing narratively, or you don't want to look at it symbolically or whatever, just, like, on the, like, pacing and visual imagery and, like, the art of filmmaking in and of itself as, like, expressionism, and of just, like, showing you these images and showing them to you in sequence and making them visually interesting and compelling. Like, this, it's so fucking good. It's just amazing to watch. It's really fun. But I think it's also, it's another place where it gets sort of weirdly biblical in places of it. It feels to me like it is, like, a Christ thing, basically. Like, you have, you know, whatever, like, because again, like, there's the Trinity stuff of, like, that's what they called the first bomb testing, but then there's the Trinity of the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, and there's, like, this sense of, like, if you want to break down what is happening narratively, I guess it would be the giant and this woman or whatever are these, like, benevolent figures that see that the nuclear bomb has created this, like, creature of pure evil, which we're assuming is just Bob. And so to counteract that in some way, they have made Laura Palmer. Like, and like I want to put, like, Laura Palmer in, like, quotations. That's, like, Laura Palmer, I feel like, in that sequence is the visual shorthand for the audience. That's, like, it's not literally just Laura Palmer. It's, like, what Laura Palmer is supposed to be.
It's the idealized image that's used in all, like, the marketing. And it's her prom picture.
Yeah, her prom picture from the school.
Yeah, it's not Laura Palmer in all her human imperfections. No. It's idealized prom queen, perfect young woman Laura Palmer.
Yeah, it's the promise of Laura Palmer and, like, who you want Laura Palmer to be and represent of, like, this, like, perfect American young woman that, like, is, you know, she does the Meal on Wheels project and all that kind of stuff. It's like, she's the prom queen, she's smart, she's like, does all this great stuff for the community, and she's just this, like, you know, idol, basically.
And I was thinking throughout this of, like, Greek creation stories. Of, like, this god and goddess in this high tower looking down on humanity, and they decide to create something to, like, send down to Earth to, like, create some kind of peace. Like, that kind of story, I say Greek, you could go with any civilization. Yeah. They all have these stories. It's actually very universal, I think, what's going on in that. Just, like, it's universal in the way those images just speak to us as a narrative in a way the shorthand just works, you know? Yeah. But yeah, and that's actually the end of this whole sequence, because then we have this long shot, not long duration, but it's a far shot, yeah. And it fades to black and all of that, and the giant is still levitating and everything. And yeah, I mean, the episode could end there, and it's a great little short film, just again as like the Lynch creation story of like, there's the nuclear bomb, here's the darkness bequeathed upon Earth, here's the lightness bequeathed upon Earth, and all the stories we've seen in the Twin Peaks universe, which might as well also include Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive and all that, are parts of that struggle, you know? Which is nowhere near as clean as maybe we might think from that.
I like the notion of this being like, there is this Lynch multiverse or whatever, that like, this is like over all of it, and it's like, they all exist in, like, it's like Bioshock Infinite style, they all exist in parallel, and it's just this story of like, the good of America and the evil of America bouncing off and sort of conflicting with one another and contradicting one another.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked before about, you know, why Bob is interesting is because he's a symbol in original Twin Peaks. That, like, what Bob is this darkness in, like, the nuclear family that ate Leland Palmer away until he was a rapist and a murderer.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that interpretation actually still stands beautifully after all of this because, yeah, what Bob is a symbol of this rot that is, did not, it existed before the bomb went off, but that really, there's a way to read that as a symbolic unleashing of that rot.
Yeah.
And that rot existed in this idyllic period. And yeah, I like that. I think in some ways in New Twin Peaks, Lynch has literalized Bob more than ever. I also think he's returned him to his symbolic place of origin in a way that is more terrifying than ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
man,
it's a fucking thing.
It's, look, those 20 minutes are one of the best things David Lynch or any American filmmaker has ever pulled off, and it aired as episode 8 of a TV series.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking nuts.
Yeah. Part 2. We go to the New Mexico desert.
Yes.
1945 counts up to 1956.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Jonathan, is this the first time David Lynch has ever explicitly set anything of his in the 50s?
I have to think about that. You know, it's funny. I always think Blue Velvet is explicitly set in the 50s, and then I watch it, and there's no like date.
Yeah.
And in fact, the one clue you get it isn't in the 50s is that Frank has a cassette tape.
Yeah.
Other than that, everything could and should just be the 50s. Yeah. No, he has never explicitly set anything in the 1950s. So yes.
So I think that's maybe that is somehow why this is as fucking intense and crazy as it is, because it's like he's always been alluding to it. It's always been like in the corner of your vision is like the 1950s American diner and like the 1950s American cars and like the 1950s American girl with like her perfect dress and perfect hair and everything, but it's always been in the corner of your vision. He's never like fully stared at it, and this is him just fucking staring it in the face, and it is so amazing.
1956, August 5th, New Mexico desert. I love August 5th. I don't know why. I'd have to look up if anything significant happened on August 5th, 1956.
Yeah,
I haven't.
I don't know.
But, yeah. So we have another shot of the desert sands, and there's a little egg in the sand, and it begins to hatch, and some kind of creature, not of this earth, it's vaguely reptilian, it's vaguely insectoid, crawls out and just slowly works its way across the sand. And we have another shot of the moon that we actually saw in the Twin Peaks proper segments of the episode. I'd not set in Twin Peaks, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then the darkness like encroaches on the moon. And then we're at this gas station or something, and we have this young man and young woman, like, you know, teenagers, maybe middle schoolers. They're pretty young.
They look very young, yeah.
Like first date kind of thing.
I mean, middle school did not exist in 1956. They would not have technically been middle schoolers, but...
Yeah. But like very much first date kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they're talking about how they like the song they just heard, and I love the young girl in this is actually really good, and she says, "Oh, look, I found a penny." And it's heads
it's
up.
It's a very David Lynch performance, and it's very good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like David Lynch possessed this young woman... And just did the performance.
It's like Naomi Watts from Mulholland Drive levels of, like, insane naivety and innocence that you're like, whoa. Yep.
And it's heads up. That means it's good luck. And the boy says, "I hope it does bring you good luck." And it's really, it would all be so sweet and charming if this weren't scary black and white David Lynch.
And if we hadn't just, like, sat through his waking fucking nightmare, you know.
And we haven't seen anything yet. Yeah, and then we go out into the desert again, and a body just flies down to Earth. And it rests on the ground and walks confidently forward, and a couple of them do it, and it's a shadowy figure. We can't make out much about it, even when it gets close to us. Eventually we will see these are the homeless devils, whatever we want to call them. And then we have that scene we talked about earlier where there's that old couple driving their car down the road.
Yeah.
And then there's the guy who goes, "Got a light? Got a light. Oh, it's terrifying. The woman in the car screams. The man accelerates. Again, it plays like their nightmare.
Yeah.
Yeah, we broke that scene down pretty thoroughly. Yeah. But it's, again, the blacks and whites in all of this are so terrifying. I want David Lynch to just make a small town horror movie after this.
Yeah.
You know?
It would be like, very good.
Showtime, if this was a hit, just give him more money.
Yeah.
And just let him make, like, David Lynch's fun time happy hour. And every week he does something crazy that's definitely not fun time happy.
It's just, in a couple of years, you just rebrand Showtime as the David Lynch channel. Viewers beware.
Channels have gotten niche enough that that wouldn't be the silliest thing in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
It would be the greatest thing in the world.
Absolutely. Though. So anyway, then we're back with the young couple, and I like that this is juxtaposition where actually the homeless people never directly interact with the young couple.
Yeah.
I mean, they do kind of metaphysically, but yeah, like that juxtaposition is very powerful. And they have this, again, you talk about how perfectly Lynchian a performance that is, the way she asks this series of questions to the boy. You live in town, don't you? You live by the school. How did you know that? I just do. So, I thought you were going with Mary. No, that's over. Are you sad about that? No. Okay, that's good. Just the Lynchian stilt on all of that is wonderful.
It's just, I just feel like you have like the school and Mary are the exact same thing as like the farm and the numbers, you know? It's just like these weird like fucking cardboard stand-ins for actual concepts. It's really... Like, I don't know what he tells these actors to do to say those words, but somehow he gets them all to do, like, the exact same perfect thing every time they say those words.
That's great. And actually, that shot is another great one, because it's a really long shot where they are, like, little figures kind of in the distance, and there's a big tree, and there's some houses. And it's that beautiful kind of shot of, like, suburban America that is both beautiful and idyllic and scary that I think every kid has experienced if they live in that kind of Midwestern setting.
Right, yeah.
You know, I have definitely felt that at times in my life in Colorado or Iowa, where I just live and stuff like that. So it's like, yeah, it's all of that is just on point. The cinematography here, man. And then we get to the main shadowy body in the episode, Mr. Got a Light, walking through the desert towards a radio tower. And we have a song playing. It is a song, My Prayer, by the... Oh, now I forget their names. I looked it up and I actually listened to the song.
Ah.
But anyway, old-timey band and a singing group. And the radio studio KPJK, someone's probably trying to figure out what that means.
Yeah.
No. We have that, and we see that there's this group of people listening to the radio. There's a mechanic working on a car, there's a woman cleaning up an empty diner, which makes us think of the RR Diner, and then there's the girl from before sitting in her room, as kind of a breeze blows in, she's kind of in the afterglow of that nice little date she had, and all the while, one of those evil figures approaches the studio, and he goes inside, there's a secretary arranging files, got a light.
Yeah.
Got a light. And then she turns into stuttering slow motion. He grabs her head, squeezes her to death or something because the image shakes and just erupts in blood.
Yeah, it's like how they tried to show people getting shot by like Daleks or something in classic Doctor Who, only you had like a gallons of fake blood in the image as well. Like it like distorts in this really crazy way and like the image just like compresses and then you just see all this blood and like her skull has been like utterly eviscerated by his bare hands.
And what I love about all of this is the music continues. It's like the only soundtrack. It doesn't even like dissipate. But then he gets into the radio studio and he turns off the record. Everyone notices that. We get that again succession of the mechanic, the diner lady, the little girl. And then he gets on the radio and starts saying something over and over. And I did not catch it the first time. I could not find all the words, but I did look it up afterwards. And he says...
Yeah. And while he's doing this, he also has the radio DJ's head in a like one-handed death grip with of his skull. And so it's like while he's saying all this stuff, whenever it cuts to him, you just get all these like sounds of like cracking and like...
Oh, the sound effects are so brutal.
It's really harsh. And it's like the whole time you're like, motherfucker, you killed that lady in like 5 seconds. And like... You take like 10 minutes to kill this poor sad guy. Like, just fucking put him out of his misery.
So he repeats over and over again, this is the water, and this is the well. Drink full and descend. The horse is the light of the eye and dark within.
This is the water, and this is the well. And he just says it like 50 times.
And it is scary every time.
Yeah.
And the mechanic just like drops to the floor, maybe dead, who knows. The diner lady drops to the floor, maybe dead, who knows. And finally, the little girl doesn't drop dead or anything, but she lays down comfortably in bed near the window. And we see the creature outside. Yeah. It has arrived at her house. And it uses its wings and flies kind of uncomfortably because it looks kind of fat up in through the window. And the girl opens her mouth like she's possessed. And the bug just crawls all the way on in. And it's scary.
It is very scary. And then...
And it recalls a million different pieces of body horror from the 50s. Like, that is one of the most 50s horror things in the whole episode. What were you going
to
say?
Well, then like, just like to continue on, and then we'll go and unpack all of them. Because we're basically at the end of the episode. So then the Gidalite man fucking just kills the DJ, just like, you know, cracks his skull open.
And just so many gallons of fake blood come out.
It's an absurd amount of fake blood. It is very intense. And then he slowly saunters out, leaves, and like exits into like the darkness of the frame. You hear horses start to neigh. The credits come up, and then over the credits it cuts back to the girl sleeping in her cot, and then that's the end of the episode.
That took some balls.
Yeah.
To do that. How do you think Kyle MacLachlan feels that since he's the only guy who's in every episode, the first name you see at the end of this is starring Kyle MacLachlan?
Yeah.
Like, he probably never wants to show that to his kids and have them associate his name with that.
With this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Like you said earlier, it's like this almost plays like its own sort of like horror short film in a lot of ways. But it is also like, but there are like obviously like very direct narrative connections to the big crazy montage sequence. So how do you want to like break this down and analyze more of it closely?
The bug thing. I mean,
yeah. So like how I saw it initially, like immediately read that creature. And then, like, the closer I looked at it, like, I'm more reinforced in this of, like, what it is. But I haven't seen other people do this, so I, like, maybe this is a crazy way to read it. It makes sense to me. That thing looks like it is, like, the back half of it is a frog, and the front half of it is a locust.
Yeah.
Which is, going back to the biblical stuff, like, those are two of the plagues that visited Egypt in the Book of Exodus. They're also, like, locusts and frogs are heavily thematized in the Book of Revelations, which is Armageddon. And, like, that thing just feels like it is the most disgusting fucking animal you could possibly create. That is just, it's like fat and weird. Like, and the thing that particularly gets me is that like its hind legs are frog legs, and then it has like, looks like these like sort of half developed front legs, and then it's just got like normal like cockroachy locusty kind of like legs up front, and that's the part of it that really fucks with me. That's also like the sound design with like the wings and everything on it are very good. It's very unsettling. But yeah, like that. I think you could also read the insect part of it as being more like cockroach-esque if you wanted to, because that also has like the nuclear connection if you want to like break it down. But that's what it like read to me is like, it's like, because it's very specifically two different animals.
Yeah,
one of which looks like a frog, one of which looks like an insect that I would call a locust.
Yeah. So, what do you think it means? The journey it goes on.
It's just like. Like, if you want, like, again, because I don't like always just, like trying to break down the Lynch stuff into direct symbolism. But I think in some ways this feels like the most directly symbolic he ever really gets. Like, I don't feel like he sort of, like, toys around with symbolism in, like, Mulholland Drive, but in this, like, very weird way where you're, like,
He makes fun of symbolism.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't think the key means fucking jack shit in Mulholland Drive, other than, like, it's supposed to be, like, evocative. It's supposed to give you, like, this impression of something, but it's, like, the key does not, like, mean a penis. It does not mean Jesus Christ. It's, like, it is not, like, that one-to-one. In this episode, I think, like, the repeated biblical images and like the creation of Laura Palmer and her being sent to Earth, like Jesus was, like in response to like evil being created, like the creation of the universe, sort of like Genesis imagery of the explosion, if that is supposed to be a frog and a locust, like that is about as like explicitly fucking biblical symbolism as you can almost get at some point, because that's some Old Testament shit, that's some old Bible. And then also, like, I think, like, the homeless people are there, basically the horsemen of the apocalypse. Because when he recedes into the darkness, you hear horses neighing, and there are no horses anywhere in the episode. And, like, I don't want to, like, go to, like, oh, like, this dude is pestilence and that one's famine. Because I never even counted. Because I think there's, like, three of them, it looked like. I don't know if there was supposed to be four or not. It was kind of, like, hard to tell how many distinct figures there were because of how they're edited on screen. Like earlier, they're kind of omnipresent whenever they're like all in a scene together. But it definitely has like, I think it's just pulling all these images of this is like the beginning of the end. This is Armageddon. This is the end times. This is the creation of, like, this is what Bob is the festering evil and darkness at the heart of, like, specifically America for like Lynch's, you know, filmography and like the themes he's interested in and like what Twin Peaks is interested in is like American stuff. And I think that's just, that is what it is. Like, it is, to me, if you're, like, the narrative, like, the literal narrative reading, as much as that exists for what this episode is it is the origin story of Bob and how he was created. And,
yeah.
And it is visceral, it is intense, it is disturbing, it is excessively dark, but, it, like, it is, it, it's telling the origin story of Bob in the only way you can, which is, like, entirely impressionistic and, like, with these, like, weird symbols and weird abstract images.
You know, I understand the instinct of some viewers and even listeners who I've talked to on Twitter about this of like trying to say like who is the girl at the end,
right?
And, and why, you know, the bug crawls on her and what does that mean and who is she in the Twin Peaks verse? And I get that instinct. It's just not for me because what that scene reads to me as is one, I don't think there's any real way you can connect that dot, those dots of like she is this person in you know, because all the ones I've heard, it's just like. Do the math from 1956 to when Twin Peaks starts and none of this really holds water, right?
Yeah.
And things like that. But, like, beyond that, to me, where I read that scene isn't that kind of way. It is what you're talking about, which is kind of impressionistic symbolism, which is what that means of this, like, apocalypse Armageddon beast. This these two plagues together crawling down her throat is that here we have pure, innocent, virginal little girl, you know, like, on this, you know, pure little 50s date that you've seen in a million movies from the 50s and things like that. Like, this perfect idol at, in this nice middle-class home, and it just crawls in through the window, and it now lives inside her.
Yeah.
And as it does inside kind of everyone, and if that kind of pure image we all have can be infected, anything can, that's even more visceral than any of the murders or anything, I think, in a lot of ways, because there's nothing as absolute about it. But that is what the episode is about, ultimately, is these infections and these plagues and these, you know, things that come out of that nuclear cloud symbolically, but really out of the culture and kind of pervade everything through the darkness of the night. And then at the end, there's a horse and it rides off to do it again somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, here's why Twin Peaks The Return in its entirety is going to have to be included in any critical appraisals of Lynch going forward, is that I don't know where the story is going from here, and I don't know where he's going to end this. I think this is a significantly more cynical David Lynch than we've had before.
I agree, yeah. Like, that's something I've been feeling for a while, but, like, it's like kind of like with the, like, how deep is he going to go into this stuff? It was hard to tell up till now, where it's like, now we have 8 hours of this TV show, and it's like, it is... You cannot ignore the fact that, like there's no other fucking David Lynch thing would show, like, the kid getting run over like he did a couple of episodes ago. You know? Like,
I mean,
it's how intensely dark he goes. He's never gone that, like, deep with it before.
Here's the comparison I think of. Akira Kurosawa, great director. He always had a certain fatalist streak to him, but if you look at his earlier post-war movies, Rashomon, Seven Samurai, Yojimbo, Sandro Less is actually a pretty cynical movie, but those ones I was naming, there is a certain amount of humanism to them. Rashomon has an ending that affirms a belief in humanity. Seven Samurai has a bleak ending that affirms a vision in, you know, countryside Japanese, like the goodness of people.
Sure, I don't know if I would quite read it that way. I mean, it does have, like, you can read it as, like, this happy, like, thing of, like, where the peasants are able to live on and move past that stuff, but all this, at the same time, like, none of, like, the deeper sort of, like, thematic or philosophical issues have been resolved of, like, the class structures in the society that have created all the situations.
But it's not, I don't know if it's purely cynical. I think there's, like, a lot of layers of reading to that.
Okay,
I know I'm oversimplifying.
Yeah, it's a very conflicted ending to that movie.
Yes, it's same kind of things with Yojimbo and some of the movies in there. And as he goes along, he gets harder-edged and harder-edged until the last phase of Kurosawa's career, at least in his big movies, is very fatalist.
Yeah.
Like, Ron is one of the most cynical movies you will ever watch.
Yeah.
Certainly on that scale. And I'm actually not as familiar with his last couple of movies where he got kind of experimental. Although Dreams just came out on Criterion, and I do have that. I haven't watched it yet. But I do have that. I'll need to watch it. Because as I understand it, he kind of turns around again. But Akira Kurosawa, I think, did, like, side with cynicism the older he got.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like,
I can get with that.
It's always there. It gets more prevalent.
Yeah.
Is a way you can phrase that. And, like, if he made Seven Samurai 20 years later, there wouldn't be any of the, like, like the little moralizing at the end.
Right.
There would just be, this was all for nothing, you know? And that's not how it's framed, at least directly in Seven Samurai. So I think of that with this as like, maybe David Lynch is headed in a similar direction where, you know, Blue Velvet is very conflicted in its vision, but it also, it affirms certain things.
Yeah.
And Twin Peaks affirms certain things. And all, you know, you can kind of go through the list. Mulholland Drive, I don't know if it's that direct. It's not as connected to some of his other things. But like Inland Empire, if you can draw any concrete conclusions to that movie, very dark. And then this is like, boy, that's cynical. And it is an interesting career arc, you know, that maybe he's gotten cynical with old age. And we're not even halfway through this. Who knows where it goes from here? But boy, as you say, like the David Lynch of Blue Velvet wouldn't ever show the kid getting run over by the car or anything that happens in this episode.
Yeah. Like it's fucking, it's just a brutal episode.
I mean, just the fact that, you know, the body of happy-go-lucky Dale Cooper has been taken over by a being of pure evil, and they're leaning into that, not out of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's a cynical version of David Lynch.
Yeah, and it's, like, that is, like, the other thing, like, that at the ending of this episode, the fact that the creature inhabits this little girl, like, it sort of made me more easily accept how, like, they've handled the Cooper stuff. Like, not, like, specifically, I think they've done perfectly fine with Evil Cooper in Twin Peaks The Return in and of itself, but, like, for original Twin Peaks, I've always thought that choice was fucking stupid at the end, because it didn't make any sense, I think, for old Twin Peaks' worldview for Cooper to be inhabited by Bob.
Oh, it's such a dark ending, dude. Not that dark a show.
And, it just didn't really make sense. Like, I don't think, like, I don't think that series made a strong argument for why that would make sense in a thematic sense. Whatever, like, in terms of the metaphysical laws of the Twin Peaks universe, I'm sure someone has fucking written an equivalent of a thesis on that. But in terms of the thematics of that series, it just never really sit right with me. And this, like, I think how heavily they are now leaning into Bob being this symbol of being, like, literally, like, in some ways, this literalized version of all the darkness that, of like the dark underbelly of America that David Lynch has thematized in almost all of his works, and like Bobby's all of that like packed into one beautiful leather jacket wearing man, and then him showing it inhabiting that girl makes it like easier for me to be like, maybe like Cooper does have some of that darkness in him that like old Twin Peaks was never able to get into that because of the kind of show it was, and this I think implies that like, that exists in everyone, no matter who you, because like no matter who you are, again, we are living in a world that is built on bodies, is built on skeletons, is built on like literally built on gravestones in a lot of cases, and that's like, we are in some weird like broader way, we are all kind of complicit in those evils, and I think like that's one of the things that makes this episode like uncomfortable to watch, is that nobody can like hide from that. I think everyone like acknowledges that on some level, and we all want to just like forget about it for most of our lives to keep ourselves sane, but you have to confront it every now and then, and like acknowledge the position we all exist in the world, and like how we exist in the world.
It's dark. It's not fun to think about, but
no.
Boy, is it artistically fascinating.
I mean, it's like, it's just is one of the strongest, if not maybe for specifically what it's getting at, I think like one of like maybe the strongest cinematic arguments I've seen like interrogating those questions and those themes. Like that's fucking crazy. You know, like we were all really excited about this like new Twin Peaks, particularly when they said that, oh, like David Lynch is directing every single episode, and like we both went into this with like the mindset of who knows how whatever the fuck this is going to be as a continuation of Twin Peaks, who gives a shit? It's like this is 18 hours of David Lynch, and that's going to be at least fascinating, even if who knows if it might be not good, who knows? But this is like, I think by the time this is done, this will be the best thing he's ever done. Like
it'll be the most all-encompassing thing he's ever done. Yeah,
like, this is just this episode, and also I think like the way that the rest of this TV show is able to like makes it so that this episode can exist, because I think a lot of your takeaway from this episode happens because it does exist in juxtaposition with the rest of the series up to this point, and gives you this like framework with which to understand the really abstract imagery and the very expressionistic take he does. In this episode, and without that framework, I don't think it would have been as narratively interesting.
this series feels like something he's been building to his whole life.
Yeah.
And his whole career. And, you know, and the circularity of coming back around to a lot of the stuff, I think, from Eraserhead is part of that. That this, you know, this could be the last filmed thing he ever does. That would be probably a safe prediction, honestly.
Yeah. Like,
and I'm not trying to be morbid or anything, but yeah. One other thought I had when you're talking about Bob and all that. Obviously, it's very sad that Frank Silva died as young as he did.
Yeah.
And obviously wish he were still with us. That said, not having access to Frank Silva, I think, has made this show stronger. Like,
sure.
Not being able to have him on set, be a body, be a presence. Like, I would kind of almost hope that even if Frank Silva were alive, maybe they don't call him back for this. Because just having him be that, like, he's stuck at that age, he is that image, and that most of what they do with Bob is not... Like, you use Frank Silva just a couple of times to indicate this is Bob, but otherwise he is a set of ideas, he is a set of feelings, he is an atmosphere, he is an attitude, all these things, makes that idea and that character so much more potent than when it is literally personified.
Yeah.
You know? So it's just, something I was thinking about there.
Yeah, I agree that it's like, because it's one of those things of where, you know, sort of going back to the Laura Palmer thing in this episode, is that you have that sort of like compared, like it like contrasted with the like weird distorted image of Frank Silva's face in like the bile of this insane smoke creature or whatever the fuck that thing is. It's like, I wonder how like deep we're going to get into that, because like you said in your notes, like it, I don't know if it was supposed to be the exact same creature from the cage, but it looked visually very similar. I haven't gone back to the first episode to compare it, but that's like what I thought of immediately. But you have like these contrasted images of them, of Frank Silva and Cheryl Lee as Bob and then Laura Palmer. But it's like, they're not... I like what this episode does is like, that's not supposed to literally be them. And that's why it's like, when people are talking about like, oh, like that girl is literally like Laura Palmer's mom or something, or it's like, it's that like direct, or like, this is like, I saw some people say, like trying to interpret the scene with the giant as like that taking place in the future to the point of where it would have made sense that that's like right before Laura Palmer is born, literally. It's like, no, like there's like... They're working off of this established language that you, as people who have all seen Twin Peaks, and like hopefully understand of like it's not supposed to be literal, actual, physical Laura Palmer, the human being. It's also not supposed to be literal, physical, actual like Bob in the as looking like Frank Silva from the original Twin Peaks and Fire Walk With Me. Those are just stand-ins that we all, as people who have watched Twin Peaks, recognize as being this certain thing, and like. That's what symbolism is. And I think it's really fascinating because you usually don't have symbolism used that way in a show where it's not referencing, using symbolism to reference something like exterior with like the Bible, which is, that's like how you normally do it. It is like, it is referencing within itself to create a larger argument. And that's a really fucking awesome technique. And it's something that only a TV show could do.
I love that there is an episode of a show called Twin Peaks that centers around a fashion show gone awry because of a love triangle and a pine weasel.
Uh-huh.
And I love that there's also an episode of a show called Twin Peaks that is this.
Uh-huh.
That has to be the widest gap in tone.
And just like quality of filmmaking and storytelling.
Under the same banner. Like, again, it annoys me when people call this season 3 of Twin Peaks. That's a stupid way to phrase it.
Yeah.
Because it's not. But like, they are still called Twin Peaks. And I love that they're the same... universe.
Yeah, it, like, because it really, this show feels like it just uses Twin Peaks as like this fucking axe or something that it can use, like old Twin Peaks, to like, it's, or the, not an axe or whatever, it's like a toolbox, and it can just like go into this toolbox and like use all these things as shorthand because we know all of these characters and we know a lot of these ideas, and but it's not interested like in giving you old Cooper back, obviously, because we had a whole fucking episode, like, he has been out of commission for 8 episodes so far, and this episode he didn't appear in it at all.
Kyle MacLachlan did, but he did not.
Kyle MacLachlan did, but like the Cooper we know, who's, or like who's like lived in the life of Dougie Jones for a while, did not appear in this episode at all. Instead, it was this fucking, most of it was this insane like nightmare produced by an acid trip or something, you know?
Yeah,
it's like. This episode is also, I think, indicates how strong the episodic storytelling is in Twin Peaks. Is like, it highlights it because of how bottled the nature of it is. But I think it has been true for almost every episode of this season, with like the exception of like the pilot is kind of weird because it's really one 2-hour long episode that they'd say is 2 episodes. But I think while the show is telling this like long serial story, and we've talked about that a lot, like with last episode, is clearly like interested in telling this big 18-hour story, it knows how to divide that 18-hour story into discrete, like concrete, digestible chunks that exist on their own and tell their own story that you can appreciate on their own merit.
When David Lynch and David Nevins, the head of Showtime, say like, oh yeah, they just shot from one long shooting script and didn't know how many episodes it would be, I think that's disingenuous. I would imagine there was something in that script that like they had an idea of what the episodes were. I think that's pretty clear when you watch it.
Also, or like they're just unbelievable geniuses at editing and we're able to say like we shot like the equivalent of 18 hours when this will be edited down and somehow we are able to like perfectly craft these 18 individual episodes. Who knows?
Yeah. Anyway. So a couple of questions.
Okay.
How hard do you think the people at Showtime shit their pants when they saw this? And like we have to put this on our network.
My theory for how this exists is that there is one executive at Showtime who has like staked literally their entire like life and career in television production to make this happen, like come hell or high water. And he was just like, I'm going to cash in every chip I have, every resource. And like, after this is over, I'm fucking quitting my job and like moving to fucking Mexico or something and just like disappearing from the world. All I want is to make this thing exist. And so my theory is they had the screening of like the rough screening of an early version of the episode to like all the executives and everyone at Showtime. And at the end, it's like, you know, it's like, imagine, you know, like we saw the whole episode and then like a camera pulls out into a boardroom and this is reverse shot and you have all the executives sitting there with just like their mouths open and like just like utter terror and just horrified. This is a horrified expression on their face. And there's this one dude just standing up clapping. It's like, fucking yes! You fucking did it, David! I knew it! This is my life's fucking dream was to make this happen. And you've blown it out of the water. I had no idea you were going to go this insane with it. But no matter what happens, this is getting on fucking television. I am Gary Showtime and this is happening.
I wanna kiss that guy if he's real. Yeah. All right. Second question. We're not even halfway through.
We're almost there. Almost at the halfway mark.
Where do we go from here? What's left? There's so much story left to tell, and yet this episode felt so big. It's like, how is this not even the halfway point?
Like this almost feels like you could have fucking like ended Twin Peaks with this episode and you'd be like, okay, yeah, like this is an insanely dark ending for the series, but like it kind of feels like it is this encapsulation of David Lynch's like entire fucking like filmography, like the ethos or whatever. I have no idea, like I said earlier at the beginning of the discussion, what the fuck does episode 18 even look like if this is episode 8? With like
we have 10 episodes.
Because remember when we thought like the shit in episode 3 was really weird this season? Yep. It's like, oh man, like this is so much crazier than any of the stuff in normal Twin Peaks. Like this is like Eraserhead level David Lynch. This is awesome. Like this like is like super Eraserhead. Like this is so crazy.
Oh, I said this on Twitter and I was only half joking. If you were previously scared of Inland Empire and you made it through this episode of Twin Peaks, don't be scared. You'll be okay.
Good. It's a walk still, in the park. I still haven't dumped into that one. I can't. But, I don't feel like I'll be able to watch Inland Empire until after Twin Peaks is done. I don't think I could eject it.
But you'll be spoiled. Like I almost would recommend at some point because Inland Empire, as interesting as it is not made with the filmmaking craft that he brought to this. Okay. Like it is a lot of interesting ideas, and there are like individual sketches that are very interesting. But like it does not have the artistic cohesiveness of what we watched on Sunday or in other episodes this year. It's so. I'm so glad this is a thing.
Yeah.
Two more weeks until we get more Twin Peaks, but next week we get a Doctor Who finale.
Yeah.
In 2 weeks we get a new Spider-Man movie. Fuck, or is that next...
I don't know.
No, that is next week. So we'll have Spider-Man... Oh my God, Spider-Man is next week.
Jesus Christ, is it really?
No, it's not. That's...
I'm going to look this up.
It's because we changed the date of the podcast. We do these on Tuesdays now. Yeah. It's July 7th, so this Friday is not, but the one after that. So it'll be a couple days after we record. But yes, Spider-Man is coming. We have so much more to talk about this summer. Oh my God, it's so busy. So Twin Peaks is continuing through September. We're not out of topics. We have some fun stuff coming up. We were going to have our 200th episode in a couple weeks here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of craziness coming up.
Yes, yes. And you are right, it is July 7th, so that will not be next episode.
But yeah, I'm all confused on dates because we're doing this midweek now. But yeah, this has been a fun summer, and it's just going to get better, I expect.
Got a light.